and welcome to the Might is Right Network at mightisright.net. At the Might is Right Network, there is streaming 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The Might is Right Network at mightisright.net. Be there!
The Might is Right! Power! Power! With your host, Bill Wright!
Network at mightisright.net for the Might is Right Power Hour podcast. I'm your host, Bill Rise, and it is July 2nd, 2015, Thursday. At the Might is Right Network, we stream 24 hours a day, some of the best white racial material that is available, and some good music as well. Okay, for this episode of the Might is Right Power Hour, I am pleased to have a special guest, and that guest is Tan Stoffel from the Age of Treason site, which is at ageoftreason.com. In the description box over at TalkShoe for this podcast, I've got that link, and a couple other links to some of the articles from that site. He has articles over there that he's written, as well as podcasts. Now, in my opinion, Tan Stoffel is one of the most rational people that I'm aware of in this struggle. And I get that from his podcast and his articles that shines through there, you know, with his writings and his podcast. When he presents an idea or a point of view, he does so very persuasively. A rational person does not just dismiss his arguments out of hand or quickly. They deserve a thorough consideration. That's warranted. So let's get right into it by bringing him up. Let me take a look here. Let's see if this is him.
Hey, that's me.
All right. Hey, Tan. Welcome to the Might is Right Power Hour and the network. I appreciate that you accepted the invitation. So welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. I'm a long-time listener. I haven't listened to everything you've ever said, but... Thank you very much for the compliment that you paid me there, and likewise to you. When you speak, what you say makes sense to me, and I like the way you think.
Thank you. To start out, how about we get to that disclosure that you wanted to mention?
Yes. Well, it's good to mention it because it will be mentioned anyway. Somebody will say it as if they're pointing it out. Back in 2010, about 2 years after I realized that I was a white man and that I had to act like a white man, and quickly thereafter realized the importance of the Jews and what was going on. It took me about two more years before I came clean and disclosed that my wife's father was a Jew, that he had died when she was young. And I said several other things in that post. I think it's basically, you know, I never put an emphasis on the extenuating circumstances, but there are extenuating circumstances. At the time when I met her and married her, I knew nothing really about the Jews. I didn't understand them. He didn't really pass on his Jewishness to her because he died relatively early in her life and was never really interested in that anyway, had married out of his tribe. But I did realize the importance of it, especially after taking two full years to further research the Jews. I mean, when I woke up to race, I very quickly understood that the Jews were enemies. And I struggled with that for a while before I realized, well, when I look at and listen to other people talking about race or the Jews, it's important to me whether they have some sort of Jewish background, because then you can sort of judge how they're trying to persuade you one way or the other. And I still do that to this day. So I thought I need to let people know so that they can, I don't know, at the very least, dismiss me if they want. If they don't want to listen to anything further I have to say, they should know that. And also, if I step out of line in any way, if I seem like I'm defending the Jews in any way, then they'll know why. But I'm pretty clear on not defending the Jews, because I chose my side a long time ago. I side with the white race, and I understand that what I've done, my situation, there's no excuse for it. And though I mentioned extenuating circumstances, I don't think that that means that I should be welcomed or accepted into whatever future white-only ethnostate whites are able to create. But I still would like to see one created, and I will do what I can to help that future come about. I don't feel like I'm trying to protect myself. I'm not trying to advance the interests of Mischlings or other people who are race mixed. I have only one overriding interest, and that is that my race survive and thrive. And so I do what little I can. I'm not active physically out at demonstrations and so forth, but I've met several people in person, and I do a podcast and I write. At the very least, I feel white people should be speaking their minds about what's going on. So that's what I try to do.
That page for the disclosure is in the description box that talks to you for this podcast. And if people are interested, they can click that. And, well, you've already heard the disclosure, but it's interesting to look at some of the comments, because you'll get pretty much the range that you would expect, with some on one side saying, well, this can't be accepted at all, and then all the way to some on the other side thinking that, sprinkle some holy water on Jews and we can accept them. You know, so you've got the whole range there from one extreme to another. But there were some individuals that I thought suggested some reasonable ways to deal with situations like that. And so people might want to check them out.
It's a painful thing for me to talk about, because I realize just how much it compromises me. I don't in any way try to minimize it or say that it's not important or it shouldn't matter. It does matter. I can't really say any more than that. I'm not going to kill myself, and I'm not going to kill my family. I haven't, and I'm not going to. I don't intend to. And if someone came after my family, I would defend them. But I'm also not going to try and argue that people like me should be carved out some sort of special consideration. I don't expect any consideration at all. And I don't think other people like me should be. I think, if anything, I'm on the hardline side as far as the one-drop rule. I think even the Nuremberg laws that the National Socialists went with was too soft. It should actually be one drop. It should be the white race in the past, as far as I can tell from looking at the history, has always erred on the wrong side, on the being too tolerant, too accepting, and shouldn't be. If it wants to survive and thrive, it's going to have to change that.
Anyway, people can go over there. Maybe you don't agree with some of the suggestions in there, but I thought there was a couple reasonable suggestions in there as to ways to deal with people in situations similar to yours. Somebody asked, the Nordic sage there is their children, yes. So they would be one quarter, right?
On average. And actually, I would say that historically that that's shown to be enough, more than enough to influence them to side with the Jews. That that's the atavistic behavior, that, that even a little bit of Jewishness, and even if they're not raised Jewish. So those extenuating circumstances I mentioned, I don't really see those as all that extenuating. They're even someone who's part Jewish needs to be excluded.
Well, sometimes it's that way with other racial groups as well, even with a quarter, that, you know, they can become very hostile, actually. Sometimes I think it's psychological, because they feel, especially like if it's Negroid or something like that, more so maybe than with Jewishness, because typical white people aren't aware of any problems with Jews, but the black thing is you can see it more physically. But even if there's just a little bit of black, they usually will side and become very hostile, or maybe not usually, but some of the time, toward whites. It might be psychological, because they think they won't be accepted as whites.
Yeah, you're right, that it's more visible with Africans because of the physical, the visible difference. But with Jews, it's just as much or more dangerous. In fact, I've encountered, there was one blogger named Unamused. He also goes by Carl Botel. He's a neo-reactionary luminary. And he is, according to his own claim, half Jewish. And I had an exchange with him at one point. He was saying things about how he'd rather live next to Nazis than niggers. And he thought he was being very brave by saying that. But when he was challenged on it, and basically it came down to he was doing what he was doing because he was trying to redeem himself and Jews as a race. He was trying to say, here, see how pro-white Jews can be, how stupid it is to try and exclude Jews just because they're Jews. And that was the point of what he was doing. That is the threat that part Jews, or even people who are indirectly connected to Jews, people who have in-laws who are Jews. You know what Dylan Roof said in his manifesto about Jews, if we could turn all the Jews blue, that would really open people's eyes. And he was right about that, but of course not just turn Jews blue, but turn all the part Jews some other color that makes them obvious, and turn all the people who are in some sort of relationship with Jews. If you could light up all of those people, I think even people who consider themselves Jew-wise would be shocked at just how thorough the infiltration has been.
Sure, and there are people that think that it's just ideology, and I tend to think there is a genetic aspect. I know it's complicated because you've got all these different mixes and different types of Jews, and then again, the typical type of Jew that we can recognize, and some of them we can't, a lot of times they don't accept other people as real Jews, like the Ethiopian Jews that are Negroid, for example. But
yeah.
I just think there is a genetic component, and therefore it's not just the ideology. But there's some people that just think, oh, no big deal. Let's get them out of that ideology and everything will be fine. And I don't really buy into that. But anyway, people can go over there. I think you've covered this pretty well. If you can see the chat there, some people are asking questions, but I'm not going to answer each one of these. Like somebody says, are you pro-white? Well, listen to the guy here. Check out his site. He's harder core on the Jew issue than I am. And being a rational individual, I understand that the message trumps the messenger. Now, sometimes we don't know. Somebody could tell us something and we have no way to verify, and then we're going to put more weight maybe on the individual. Is he a known liar? Is he a drunkard or whatever? Even a liar and a drunkard can sometimes tell us the truth, though. But what I'm getting at is you listen to what the guy has to say. You check out his articles. I don't see any effort of any kind of shenanigans trying to, as Jews will do, and I know you're not Jewish, but, you know, infiltrating something and trying to, in little ways, lead it down the wrong path or anything like that. He's clearly pro-white, and clearly that seems to be the focus of what you do, is exposing the Jews. So if what the guy is saying is correct, the truth is the truth, no matter who tells it, is how I see it. Let's just get into that then. What do you think your role in this struggle is? Is there a specific goal you have in mind, a focus, something specific you want to accomplish?
Well, it's race and the Jews, really. It's trying to figure out early on, what is it? What's going on? And what does race have to do with it? What do the Jews have to do with race? And trying to understand how they relate to whites is really what my specialty has been, as you say, digging into the Jewish question. And my understanding of it is what, and what you just said about how I'm not trying to infiltrate and lead some movement down the wrong path, is why it's not a good idea to let anyone who's compromised in the way I am, or to let anyone who's part Jewish or Jewish, of course, be members of white organizations or lead white organizations in any way, have any even membership, but certainly not to lead. And that's why I felt a bit odd when I was at the White Network, part of the White Network. But I guess we can get into that a little bit later. But basically, you know, I should not be leading anything, and I don't want to lead anything. I don't try. I'm not a leader anyway. Even if I wanted to be, I wouldn't be a good leader. But I certainly have no right to try and lead white people. I'm compromised. I'm damaged goods. And I have to admit that even when I study subjects and try to come up with my take on them, and then print them, publish them, I feel even that's kind of borderline. I'm already sort of forming an opinion and then sharing that opinion. And sometimes I defend that opinion against people who come in and criticize it, you know, basically a thought leader. And I struggle with this myself. Should I just shut up and step aside? And, you know, I have no right to be even saying anything about this. But part of what allows me to continue to rationalize what I do and to continue doing it is that I am trying to help. I'm trying to be entirely for whites and to help whites understand, especially people who might have been in a position similar to mine, who saw things the way I used to see them or still do. And so I focus on things like this white-Jew fault line, the fact that Jews aren't white, the fact that Jews are anti-white. They're the source of anti-whiteness and the history of it. And so, you know, and everything that's involved with that subject. That's my main area, and that's my role. My role I described in the past as analyst. That's what I do for a living with software. You know, I write software. I solve problems with computers. And so I apply a lot of what I had honed my mind to do for 20-odd years before I started with race and the Jews, and I just really have applied those same skills then to this problem of what's happening to whites right now, to try and come up with answers, try and analyze the problem and suggest solutions.
The White Network, you mentioned that. Is there anything you want to say about that, your time with the White Network, Carolyn Yeager and all that?
Yeah, I liked Carolyn Yeager's podcast very much when she was at Voice of Reason. She really opened my eyes to the whole Holocaust narrative and World War II history, which I had always had an interest in myself. But I hadn't really confronted the Holocaust until I started listening to her podcast. And so I learned a lot from that. I admired her greatly. I went and listened to every single one of her podcasts. And I did a couple of interviews with her back in the beginning of 2012, and she said that she was unhappy with the Voice of Reason, which was not an explicitly pro-white, anti-Jewish network, and she wanted to, you know, she floated the idea to me, as someone who had the technical skills, to create a new network where we could be explicitly pro-white. She had been dabbling in more and more in the explicitly racialist attitude. Anyone who's familiar with Holocaust revisionism knows that, you know, half of them don't even want to deal with the issue of race or the Jews as a race or who the Jews are exactly. They just want to like set the record straight about the facts about the Holocaust. And what I thought was unique about Carolyn was that she seemed to be showing signs that she understood the racial dimension of it as well, that it was actually Jewish aggression and a Jewish racial animosity for whites in the Holocaust narrative that they tell. And so I thought it was a good match there, that I was more interested in the race and Jewish issue. She was more interested in the German history and Holocaust issue and the Jews, and expressed interest in race. So anyway, we, I think, did a good job for 2 years talking about all of that stuff. But in the end, it was there was a mismatch there, and there was some stress toward the end. There were several things that I thought were unacceptable to me and that I didn't want to be associated with anymore. I didn't want to support. But over time, the things she said made sense. I mean, the thing that attracted me to Carolyn Yeager, and I haven't listened to her in a year, so I don't know, I assume she's back on track doing something similar now, is she's logical most of the time. But the problem is that she fills in sometimes where she doesn't have logical arguments to make. She fills it in with her intuitions about what things are. And I really didn't like that when she, at the very end, ended up quoting Jews, anti-white Jews. I forget the fellow's name, Zeskind, Leonard Zeskind, quoted, you know, just read verbatim from Wikipedia what he had to say about white nationalism. And I thought, this is bizarre. I don't want to deal with this. So I put the network on. I was the technical person who did all the technical stuff. So I just, you know, froze it and said, it's going to be read-only from here on. I want a divorce, basically. And I said I didn't want to be involved with her anymore. I didn't want to work with her anymore. End of story. And I think we did good work, though. Especially one thing I want to highlight is the work that Padding Scott did with Carolyn on the international Jew. It was reading Henry Ford's work from beginning to end, along with contemporary, insightful commentary from two racialists who understood, maybe Padding more so than Carolyn, but adding commentary, so bringing it up to date sort of and relating it to contemporary events and what's happened since, in 100 years since that book was written. And I've always enjoyed that series, and I think it's solid gold. I restored the contents from backup to a new domain name and added one more post to it, or two more posts explaining what had happened. And so all the details are there for whoever wants to read it. It was a burden on me, and I didn't see the need for it. She could do what she's doing. As I understand, she continues to blog and podcast. But through the 2 years, it was basically like for a master's degree for me in race and Jews, because the regular schedule every week, having to do a podcast, kind of compelled me to sit down and grapple with issues that I had long wanted to deal with. It was only a few months before I exhausted all the things I had previously researched, and I was really digging into things fresh. And that was like a college course or a college course of study, a degree, to go through those things. And I enjoyed doing that part of it. And when I realized after 2 years I could keep doing that, but on my own, I did that.
I just want to say, since I did bring it up, that, you know, I like what Carolyn Yeager does, her podcast, especially, you know, when she focuses on, oh, that whole time frame, the National Socialists, Adolf Hitler, the Holocaust, all that kind of stuff. And I think she does good work in that area. And I just personally think she's honest. And when I say somebody's honest, you know, as they see it, you know what I mean? It could be a case of just two people conflicting personalities or whatever, or understanding things wrong, taking things wrong. But I do get the impression that she's honest. That doesn't necessarily mean if somebody's honest that everything they say is true or correct, but what I'm getting at is that she thinks it is. And I think most of the time she's probably spot on, but not all of the time. Anyway, I want to move on from that. Back to something you said earlier, you weren't sure if you should be, you know, saying anything because of your situation. Well, some people in the chat, or at least Urban Jungle Girl, mentioned that she appreciates that you have, you know, written articles and done podcasts, and I do too, because you've actually made me think about some things, and I like that, and even swayed me. So I'm glad that, you know, you have decided to go ahead and do what you're doing and not refrain from it because of your personal situation. And along those lines, you make strong arguments for using the term genocide rather than the term racial suicide for describing the situation our race is in. And I use both terms, But you actually, you know, got me to really think about that. So go ahead and explain your position on the term genocide rather than racial suicide.
Yeah, this has been one of my major themes for years now. I understand that some people, when they use the word suicide, like yourself, I've seen Kevin McDonald use it as well. I understand that what you mean by it, and you qualify it by saying racial suicide, not just suicide. And in context, McDonald does something similar. You know, what people are trying to express is they're trying to describe this phenomenon that's going on. My point about suicide is that it's personal. It's conscious. There's reasons why the word suicide doesn't really, it doesn't fit what's happening. It isn't a good description of what's happening. And my first objection to its use wasn't even from people like you or McDonald using it, from pro-whites using it. It was from Jews. It was from people who, in these borderline forms around and outside of white nationalism or pro-white, explicitly Jew-wise places where the Jews are openly discussed, in these places like it was Lawrence Oster who I saw using it in 2008 or so, in 2009, and also the counter-jihad people who are sort of a Jew nationalist, not even really nationalist, but they're concerned about Muslims and Islam, and they're, make a long story short, it's because they're basically a Jewish movement, a Jew movement. Not everyone who's in it is Jewish, but they all put the priorities of Jews first. And these are the places where I saw them talking about what's going on and describing it as, you know, white people or Europeans and Western civilization committing suicide. And it irked me because I didn't think that that was an accurate description. And even just not even paying so much attention to the Jewish aspect of it, but just I could see that even to describe just whites, that there was a split mind amongst whites, that some whites were obviously fighting against what was going on, even though other whites were going along with it. You know, to call it suicide and imagine that the entire white race is just one mind, single-minded on this is wrong. But then as I started to understand more about the Jews and the role of the Jews in egging it on, in instigating it, in driving it, that's when I identified that particular use of the word suicide as the suicide meme, I called it, which is two parts. You're saying that the whites are killing themselves because that excuses the Jews. And I pointed out several examples of it, and then after that and years afterward, I could see different slight variations on it. The most recent variation that I've noticed is with Jared Taylor, and I assume most of the people listening understand who know who Jared Taylor is and what's special about him, how he thinks Jews are white. And he talks about white pathology. In fact, I'd say he's the main proponent of this term, white pathology, and specifically pathological altruism. The idea that white people are like cat ladies, they will help other races to the point of harming themselves. And I started to pick it apart, not when it was coming from Jared Taylor, because I wasn't even really paying attention to Jared Taylor anymore, but when I saw it coming from Kevin McDonald and a writer that he has, Andrew Joyce. You know, both of them are very good on the Jews, but what I noticed was that in the middle of a conversation about or a description of what the Jews do, how they use this term anti-Semitism and try to psychopathologize their enemies, that in response to that, what white, even Jew-aware white people who were talking about Jews manipulating them psychologically like that, like Joyce or like McDonald, that they get defensive and they fall back to, well, no, I'm not a stupid, crazy, evil anti-Semite who thinks that Jews are responsible for everything. In fact, I think whites are to blame for being pathologically altruistic. You know, whites have a pathology, and they would talk about it as if it was something separate and apart from Jews. That's an important part of it. It's almost like my two-part thing about the suicide meme. It has to be saying that whites are killing themselves, and that the second part is that it's to excuse the Jews. That's the purpose of it. With this pathological altruism argument, they're not talking about something that's a consequence of Jewish action. They're explicitly, or more or less explicitly, saying this is something that's born into whites, that we're just born suckers, and if it wasn't the Jews doing this to us, it would be somebody else. And I think that that's wrong. I think that whenever they start pointing to examples of what they're talking about when they describe pathological altruism, whether it's cat ladies or people who would adopt African babies, that you can see that, first of all, people like cat ladies never make it to political power. They're not in any position to cause damage to anyone else. They may literally suicide themselves. They may literally kill themselves, but they're not going to harm the people around them. And the people like Biden or Cameron in Britain, or any of the leaders in any of the formerly white countries that are white, that aren't Jews, are actually not suicidal at all, but very, very focused on what's good for themselves personally. What the real problem is that they've abandoned their race. They think that they're going to switch teams, or they're a team of one. It's just themselves and their close family that they care about, and or that they're going to blend themselves in with the Jews that they're surrounded by and advised by and financed by. But they've given up, and they're willing to betray the white race. And so I basically, in a critique of McDonald and Joyce, which I could see that their way of thinking was coming from Jarrett Taylor, this white pathological altruism thing. I just said, hey guys, this is it's great to talk about white pathology, but what's the pathogen? What's causing the pathology? And that was the simple point, to bring it down to a single thing that I said. And if you're going to talk about pathology and use medical terminology, let's talk about what the pathogen is then, okay? Isn't that the point? If we're talking about what the problem is, it's because we want to solve it, right? And I've never really gotten a good feeling, a good answer on that issue.
What about, I'm thinking, let's say, in terms of a virus. There can be situations where somebody, because of, let's say, their diet or their general health, maybe they exercise, or just in better health, that they can be more susceptible to something. And right now I'm not talking about whether they're immune or not, or they've had it before, so therefore their immune system recognizes it. Let's take that out of it. But just some people can be susceptible to certain illnesses because of their general health, or maybe something genetic, whatever, and others not. Is it possible that when it comes to the white race, when you mentioned the pathogen, that there is something about whites genetically that makes us more susceptible to certain types of approaches, like what the Jews use, playing with our altruism or playing with our ability to have, maybe a heightened ability for empathy, putting ourselves in other people's positions and
yes,
turning that into compassion and all that?
Yes, absolutely. My point is not that the white race is flawless and that we have no problems, that we have no vulnerabilities, or that we shouldn't try to fix those vulnerabilities. My point is that when I see people dwelling on these terms like suicide or white pathology and then stop, they don't go beyond that. They don't say, well, what's causing this? That's what I take issue with. That's what I took issue with when the Jews and jihadis were doing it. And I called it the suicide meme. And that's what I take issue with even here with McDonald and Joyce doing it, copying it from Jared Taylor. Jared Taylor, I don't even have to argue about, because I think it's clear to everyone that he's doing it because he doesn't want to talk about the Jews. So he talks about whites as if they have this pathology that comes from nowhere and we just do it to ourselves. But in the case of McDonald and Joyce, I think what the explanation was is what I pointed out when I saw it, them doing this, is, and it's really Joyce, I guess, he was really just taking his cue from McDonald mainly, is that they had been talking just before that about how the whole anti-Semitism thing works, how, Jews scream anti-Semitism and everybody gets out of their way, everybody backs off, but white, all the whites do at least, and especially white intellectuals. And then I saw Joyce actually do it, say, oh, well, I'm not one of those people who thinks Jews are just the enemy and that's the only problem. We have our own problems, and started talking about white pathology. And it was only when he laid it out there like that that I saw that even our intellects show the symptoms of it, even when they're examining it themselves. It's like watching a scientist explaining to you the bad side effects of radioactivity while he's handling some uranium, and then he wonders why his hands are melting off while he's handling it. You know, that's maybe a bad analogy, but I'm amazed, and I couldn't understand. I couldn't make sense of it. I tried. I made several podcasts trying to dig into it. I talked about, I think there is a lot to this psychology. The Jews use it as a tool against us. That is one of the vulnerabilities, that they play us like pianos that way. It's mainly our objectivity. What makes us do so well with science is our ability to step outside of ourselves and see a situation factually and objectively without bias, or at least to try to, and that we consider that an ideal. I think that comes from the Aryans. And they abuse that, and that's one of the racial personality traits that we have. That ordinarily it's good, it's powerful, but in the case of the Jews, they exploit it against us.
So even if there's weaknesses there, susceptibility there, it's still Jews taking advantage of them.
Right.
I mean, there's clearly a white genocide agenda. That's what I think they're trying to do. I think that's pretty clear. So we understand that not all white people are going along with this. Certainly the racially aware aren't, but even among the lemmings, you know, there's resistance in all sorts of realms, from immigration coming into various white countries to other aspects, the homosexual agenda, all these feminism. You know, there has been some resistance, not enough, not effective, but there's been some resistance. But in the big picture sense, if the race goes down, I don't think there's any excuses, you know, that nature will accept. Then it might be
looked at
if there wasn't enough resistance, maybe big picture it could be viewed, I don't know, as suicide, since we do have, I believe, and I think you do too, we have what it takes to survive. In fact, not just to survive, but flourish and dominate.
That's right. We do have it. And when I talk about suicide versus genocide, that's one of the points I make, is that some of the people who say, oh, no, it's suicide, by saying it's suicide, they're basically saying, they're washing their hands of it, saying, effectively, there's nothing I can do about it. Hey, if those other people want to kill themselves, there's nothing I can do about it if my race wants to kill itself. And that, you certainly, I get a feeling that that's what some people are doing when
they
call it suicide. And even there are people who won't call it suicide or genocide. They just don't want to talk about it. And for the same reason, that they don't want to think about it, because thinking about it and certainly calling it genocide implies you have a duty now to do something about it. You know, if your race is being genocide and you feel any sort of connection to it at all, you need to do something about it. And that's why I think a lot of people hesitate to call it genocide. And as far as genocide goes, the reason I prefer that term, if you have to pick any term, is because it's familiar. People understand what genocide means, and they understand that there's two parties to it, that it's not just one group deciding out of the blue to off itself. Genocide implies that there's a driving force, and there's a force that's being eliminated. And I understand it's a Jewish word, that it was a Jew who coined the phrase, and I would even say about the UN description of it, that it seems more like a recipe for how to genocide the white race than it is a commandment not to. And obviously, when people have tried to communicate to the UN that this is going on, it's being done to white people, we get no sympathy from the UN. We're not going to get sympathy from the UN. I think the main use of using the word genocide is the same thing that a lot of people think that they get when they use the word suicide, at least in a sincere way. They hope to wake up other whites to the seriousness of the situation, that this is an existential problem. We're going to be gone soon. And whether you call it suicide or genocide, and that something needs to be done about it. It's not really, sometimes I hear critics of people that are complaining about genocide, including yourself. I know you did a decent podcast on how memes are not going to save us. And everything you said, I agreed with. You had a pretty positive attitude, I thought, about the usefulness of those memes, but you also pointed out that that is not going to be enough to save us. And that's true. I agree with that. Yeah. But I try not to shit on the people who are only doing that, only talking about love your race and stop white genocide and all that. That's what they're capable of doing right now. Hopefully they'll eventually realize there's more to it and that they can do more.
Right. Well, when it comes to the memes or anything, let's say, well, it could be vocalized, but in print, you know, the expression, the pen is mightier than the sword. But I've said before, and I probably got this somewhere, you know, that the mightiness of the pen is its ability to get people to pick up and use the sword. But memes, yeah, they're very important, I think, and thoughts, words, ideas, and being expressed in various ways. But it's got to lead to something that's actual action, physical things, where some people just think that's it. All we have to do is spread words around and educate the people, and then they won't have to do anything. Everything will just magically be okay, as if then there's not going to be any hardship, any bloodshed. It's just the words. And also, when I would mention racial suicide, I do it in the sense of trying to, and of course this would only work on those that I refer to as reachable. Some people just aren't reachable. But for those who are reachable, I'm just trying to, you know, get them off their ass, like get them to, maybe it's ridicule or just, you know, beating them over the head, you know, let's not go along with this, you know, because if we do, you know, then we're joining in racial suicide. Let's be the ones that aren't going along with it. Let's fight it. Then we're fighting this genocide agenda. So I use it in that way. And I usually, when I use racial suicide, I'll mention it's also genocide. I bring that up because there's an active group out there, or groups, but we know it's the Jews leading this, you know, that have this plan. So no matter what, it is genocide as well. But I'll be honest, I'm confused on it, you know, after hearing from you, because technically, the way you describe it, it seems like technically it can't be suicide, you know, racial suicide, other than maybe in that big picture natural law sense. I don't know.
Well, I'm not suiciding myself. Are you killing yourself?
I'm not. No, no.
And so, in fact, we could use more people who are somewhat suicidal. You know, you want to talk about Dylann Roof-type people or Breivik-type people, people who are willing to put their lives on the line for their race, people who literally don't care about themselves personally. And that's kind of the irony of the people who talk about white pathology and whites being suicidal and do it in a way to basically make excuses for the Jews in order to not talk about the Jews, is that what they're saying is what we actually need more of, people who would be less concerned about their own personal interests. And you know, the other thing is you could call it Jewicide. I mean, if you're really searching for a word, you don't want to use suicide, you don't want to use genocide, then call it death by Jew, Jewicide.
Yeah, that's
because
good.
That is, to the first approximation, that is the best description of what's being done. There are traitors involved. There are white traitors. You've made that point before, too, and I think it was after you made that case pretty forcefully that I, that was about the same time that I was criticizing Joyce and McDonald, talking about pathological altruism, and pointed out the aspect of traitors, the Joe Bidens, the Bill Clintons and Camerons and so forth, that go along with this. And so it's not entirely the Jews. Pierce made that point many times, too. To call it genocide is not to somehow make excuses for the traitors. It's not to make excuses for the white race. It's not about that. It's about being more accurate about trying to describe what's going on. And if you really want to be accurate, you could say Jewicide, with the aid and abetting by traitors, white traitors.
Right. Since we're on the Jews there, the next question is, since the Jews are pursuing a white genocide agenda, what do you think about those that would say the sensible response would be at least to strive for, and that's amongst, you know, white people that are racially aware, a genocide of Jews?
The short answer is yes. That's in straightforward, eye for an eye moral terms. Yes, that is what's called for. And the longer answer has to do with my own analysis of what the relationship is between whites and Jews. And a lot of people who think about the Jews, they make the mistake, I think, of thinking of it as a conflict of interest. And this is, again, back to you know, McDonald's terminology when he describes the Jews, this conflict of interest with the Jews. And it's the mistake is in thinking that Jews are like whites, but just another group, a separate group, even an enemy or hostile group. And it's more than that. It's the analogy that I use, and it is only an analogy, really, but it's from biology, is parasitism. The Jews are parasitizing whites and have for millennia. They infiltrate our societies, they manipulate our people, and they do it in order to exploit our resources and to take advantage of us. And seeing them as parasites is it's more than just calling them a name, a nasty name, and saying, oh, you parasites, to insult them or something, or to signal how much you just must hate Jews. It actually has a useful, there's a reason to identify it as such, because a lot of work has been done on studying parasites and how do you deal with parasites and parasitology and so forth. And the answer is basically that the techniques that they're using to kill the white race are not going to work in the reverse, because the main technique that they use is fraud. The main technique is to disguise themselves and who they are and to take control of our communications, our the nerve centers of our race, and then direct them to their own uses. And I think whites, if they understood what has been done to them as a race by the Jews, would be disgusted by it and would not be able to do the same in reverse, because we aren't a race of parasites. We aren't about infiltrating other peoples and then secretly manipulating them to suck their resources out until they're a dead husk and then throwing them out and moving on to the next group. That's what the Jews have done. That's what they're evolved to do. And that's why just simply expelling them won't work either, because expulsion is sort of baked into them at this point. It's part of their life cycle, being expelled from one country and just moving over to the next one and setting up base there until they can figure out how to foment a war with their old host and punish their old host so they can get back in, is what they've been doing for this past 2,000 years and probably longer. So that's one of the insights that you get from understanding that they're a parasite and that they actually move between societies, that that's part of how they do what they do. Another thing about understanding that is the mixture aspect of it, back to the Nuremberg laws and so forth. And also in understanding the Jews, that they seem to be both racially mixed and also very inbred. The Ashkenazi Jews, and especially the ones from Eastern Europe, seem to be very racially pure. The most religious Jews are the most racially pure. And that's not a contradiction. It's really just two sides of the same organism. The racially mixed ones are the ones who are basically, you could think of them as the fangs or the claws sinking into the host society and softening it up and manipulating it most directly. But the resources that they loosen up then and vacuum up, they redirect toward the egg sac, or I called it in the past, the fruiting body, to use like a slime mold analogy. The Israel, or even just the Orthodox Jews that they sometimes complain about, they're really just two halves of the same organism. And so that's why trying to convert all the Jews with holy water or just separate them out by, you know, down to the quarter isn't going to cut it. They've already survived those kind of efforts to be rid of them. The main mistake that the white race and leaders of the white race have made throughout history is in underestimating the Jews. It's in taking half measures or local measures and thinking that they're the first ones to deal with the Jews and they're going to do it by brutally expelling them, telling them to get out. What they don't realize, and I chalk it up mainly to ignorance of history, most of the people throughout time really didn't know much about the previous history. If you remember George Lincoln Rockwell's Ducks and the Hens fable, he understood the Jews in a very deep way. That fable really gets at what they are. They take advantage of the fact that whoever the new host is doesn't really understand too much about the Jews, feels sorry for them, lets them in, shares their society with them, because there is a side of the Jews that can be productive on the surface. They tend to set themselves up as doctors, as lawyers, as advisors, they're good with money, that kind of stuff. That gets them in, and then they start intermarrying with the leadership. They start eventually taking over the country, and the United States is a good example of where that leads to. You know, at this point, we're a colony of the Jews. It's pretty sick.
In the book, The Jewish Strategy, Revelo Oliver, he was comparing, I think it was specifically on Jews versus whites, that our elites seem to be more, or could be possibly more prone to treason than, than maybe amongst, let's say, the Jews, I would think, for sure.
Well, that was his main point, was he was comparing whites to, or Aryans to, the Jews, and how our politicians will sell out for a pittance. I mean, it's ridiculous just how little money it takes to buy them. And that the Jews, on the other hand, he could only identify one or two examples of Jews who had legitimately betrayed their people. I think some of the examples I've found are back in the medieval times. Actually, throughout the history of Christianity, there have been Jews who had converted, some fraction of them, that then shared some of the teachings or the writings in their Talmud and things like that with the Christian leaders. And those things were, there was one that comes to mind, Pfefferkorn, and a handful of others. But what's most remarkable about that is that relative to whites, it's almost non-existent, that it's, they don't betray their race, their kind.
Okay.
Benjamin Friedman is another good one, I think, from the past. But in general, the ones that are held up as good Jews and as traitors to their own kind, most of them aren't. They just have a sort of iconoclastic view that differs from the majority of Jews about what's best for the Jews. They think this needs to be aired out in public. The Jews who are doing this stuff are going to get all the other Jews in trouble, and so therefore they need to be criticized. You know, it's, but the bottom line is that they're doing it actually because they do care about the Jews. You know, back to the parasitism thing, there's three ends, basically, to the parasitism relationship. One is that the parasite prevails and the host dies. The other is that the host prevails and the parasite dies. And the third is that you get into some sort of symbiosis. And there are a lot of people who are trying to moderate one way or the other to try and drag it back to some sort of symbiosis, that can't we all just get along type of attitude. I see a lot of analysts doing that, a lot of people who talk about race issues and whatever, and even a lot of Jews that try to do that. They're trying to control the thing so it doesn't get out of hand. It's not that so much they care about whites being exterminated, but they think that whites have been a very beneficial host to the Jews, and so they may not put it in those terms, but you know, basically they'll say things like, oh, America has been great for the Jews, and these Jews who are, these left-wing Jews who are doing this stuff need to stop because this is not good for the Jews, that kind of stuff, a lot of that.
Right, right. And sometimes they were clear about it, you know, Jewish people that harshly criticized leadership Jews and their agenda, you know, they made it clear they were doing that because, you know, they cared about Jews and they thought this would be disastrous for them in the end. And then also there could be others that were exposing various Jewish crimes, let's say, against our people that still could be all part of the game, you know, where there's still an agenda to kind of mislead us in a certain direction, take our eyes off this, put them there. You know, sometimes there can still be another agenda at play and they might not necessarily be against the Jews. They might be playing a role that the Jewish leadership asked them to play, you know?
Yes. Well, I think a lot of it just comes from inside themselves. They see danger, you know, a red light starts flashing in their head, and a lot of them don't even mention the Jews. They just, you know, get to work trying to create another explanation for what's going on, something that doesn't involve the Jews. So you see a lot of that. People, it's disinformation, really, and misinformation. A lot of this truther-type stuff, that the stuff that doesn't talk about the Jews, for instance, is probably Jews or half-Jews or somebody who's married to a Jew who doesn't want the Jews to be implicated, and so they're spinning the hamsters in their mind are spinning as quick as they can, and they're typing as quick as they can to come up with other explanations for it. And Alex Jones and his secret Nazis type stuff.
The individuals that come out and people would say, well, they're exposing the Jewish agenda. This can be used by the Jews if things get really down and dirty and negative for them. You know, them and their proxies can get out there and say, well, not all Jews are like this. Look at this guy. Look at that guy. You know, so they could be playing that role, too, where they come out and criticize certain things about Jews. And so that later, if things go bad for Jews, they, you know, can try to push that line that we're not all, you know, on this agenda and look at all these other Jews, you know. So in
that's
other words,
unamused,
try to get us looking for the good Jew.
That's what Unamused seemed to be doing to me. And I have to say that's rare. The more common approach for them is to just create confusion. The more confusion they can create, the more diffused the response will be, the less likely anything will rebound back onto Jews themselves. Just keep us divided, you know, the old divide and conquer tactic that they've been using against us for forever.
Right. Okay, Urban Jungle Girl asked twice, ask him about Christianity. You know, that's a big thing with her. And that was the next question anyhow. Urban,
yes.
you didn't think I'd miss that, did you? So I want to ask you what your view, and, you know, you can go as far as you want with this. You might not want to offend or whatever. But what are your views, at least what you'll share with us on Christianity, especially as it relates to those within the struggle that profess to be Christians?
Yeah. I'd like to take this opportunity to talk a bit about it. I don't talk about it much on my own blog. I have mentioned it a bit in the past, and originally my thought was not to antagonize Christians and, you know, basically Christians are decent people, that kind of thing. But I was Roman Catholic when I was a boy, but I had pretty much, by the time I was in grade school, junior high school, high school, I had abandoned that. I wasn't really excited by it at all. I didn't believe in it at all. But I called myself an agnostic for most of my life. When I moved my family to the mountains here in North Carolina, one of the things that I thought that I could try, and this was in 2008 or 9, at that point I had already heard many criticisms from racialists of Christianity. I understand the arguments against Christianity, but I got us involved with a church here, a small Methodist church. And the thing I've valued about it for this the past couple of years is the community aspect of it, meeting people, which we, you know, desperately needed to meet the people in the area. And that was one of the things that it helped us to do. That aspect of it, I think, was positive, a good experience. If you need to meet people in an area, that's great. But the church itself, I can see that from the top down, nothing but poison is coming to the preachers to be as guidance as to what to talk about, and then the preachers themselves. And I've had, you know, my conversations with the preachers, I've made it clear how I feel about things and even about the Jews. It's been interesting, an interesting experience for me. And I'm at my rope's end. I feel like a hypocrite in participating in it. It's just for the community aspect of it, the people that are involved in it, and knowing them on a personal level, because I don't believe anything about the doctrines itself. So I'm not going to be going any longer. Anyway, that's basically a confession here to you and your listeners, my readers who may not have heard me speak about this. But I've said more and more recently, as I've come to understand it myself, is that it's actually been basically more of a vector for the Jews, something that the Jews have used against whites for its whole history, than it has been a bulwark or a defensive structure against them. It's literally the first example of a Jewish intellectual movement, to put it in Kevin McDonald's terms, or of the Jewish narrative, which is the phrase that I often use. It is the Jewish narrative, their Bible, the whole idea of what Christianity is. It's also a universalist set of moral values. When I say universalist, I mean it comes up with a morality, or it espouses a morality where the same rules apply to everyone, that murder is murder no matter who commits the murder against who, and that it's not a particularism, which in contrast to the Jews and their moral code, is particularist. The Jews are the chosen people, and what they do amongst the Jews to other Jews is one set of rules, and how they treat the goyim, all the non-Jews, is a completely different set of circumstances. And this is something that most Christians don't even understand, and most people who aren't Christians have absorbed this idea that when they talk about morality, that it means Christianity, that it means spirituality. They really haven't thought very deeply about what morality means. It's really just a system or a definition of good and bad. At its base, that's what morality is. It's how do you decide what's good and what's bad. And the point I tried to make, and the understanding I've come to myself, is that it doesn't make sense. A universal morality, which most people cling to, it certainly doesn't make sense when you're faced with other groups that have their particularist morality. They basically eat your lunch. They take advantage of you. And the only real decent morality that you can define that doesn't destroy itself is a particularist morality, a morality that is centered on a particular group of people. So you have to think about, before you can think of, you know, whether something is good or bad for us, you have to think, who is us? That's the first question that has to be answered. Before you can start thinking even of good and bad, you have to start thinking, who is it good or bad for? And in the Christian mindset, is it good or bad for everybody? And it's even been pushed to the point today where it's beyond that to, it's got to be good for everybody else. If it's good for me or good for the white race, then that's bad. That's sick. And it's self-destructive. It self-abnegates. You know, it basically cancels itself out over time.
So that's
how I feel about Christianity.
And I'm not sure if you are familiar with my take on it, but people will talk about the churches and how less and less people go to church, let's say now, today, compared to 100 years ago. But I don't see that as all that positive, because I think people today, and I mean white people, but specifically here in the United States, are far more Christianized than the people were 100 years ago, when more of them went to church. Back then, people focused more on the Old Testament, right? And some of the better aspects, actually, of the Old Testament, which is filled with all sorts of garbage, but there's some sensible things in there as well. You know, the basics, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. They didn't focus as much on the New Testament, especially the Sermon on the Mount. Whereas today, even atheists that profess to hate Christianity are very Christianized, in my opinion. And it doesn't have to come from church or Bible school when you're a little kid. It comes from the electronic Jew. It comes from the newspapers. It comes from the magazines. The morality that's being put forth, whether it's direct or sometimes it's just something you're going to infer from watching the characters in a movie and how they react to somebody, you know, what's good and what's bad, what's the proper way to act, what's not, you know, what opinions are proper opinions and what are evil opinions. And so people get their concepts of good and bad from a host of areas, but I'm saying those who aren't raised as Christians, they get it right from the Jewish media. And I argue that most all of the propaganda that's aimed at our people when it comes to the moral aspects of it is still based on Christ insanity. And even in those areas where people would argue, well, wait a minute, you know, the Jews are promoting this and it's against Christian teachings, like, let's say, feminism or the homosexual agenda. Even there, they couch it in ways so that it appeals to Christian sensibilities. In other words, we can hate the sin, but not the sinner. We're still supposed to love everyone, right? So even the homosexual and, you know, so even when there's areas where the Jews are pushing propaganda and they're still trying to, you know, make us think this is moral, right? So they're pushing these ideas of right and wrong that go against specific, you know, parts of the Bible. It still falls in line with the overall Christian teachings, or at least they do it in ways that will appeal to the Christian moral code. So
I think you're right. Yeah.
So I look at there being your religious Christianity and your secular Christianity, and you listen to the lefties who say they hate Christianity, and they mainly complain about the good parts of it, and then you listen to the Christian types, and they're saying the same things. They're just using different wording, such as we're all God's children, or just the other one, you know, equality, all the races are equal. But in any case, Christianity from the get-go was about a brotherhood of men, including yes. all men on the planet, all different races, and that's what the New World Order agenda is today. So that's why I look at it as the first, maybe it's not the best term, but Marxism, or the first universalism.
Yeah, the aspect that I agree with what you're saying. The sin in secular terms is exclusion, discrimination, intolerance, hate. That's what that means. What they get upset about is any time white people see any difference between us and them, make any sort of distinction. We have one duty, whether you're a Christian or a secular liberal, and that is to create a society in which everyone is welcome. We're not allowed to keep anyone out of it. We're not allowed to even think of ourselves as separate from them, except for the purpose of giving everything we have to those other people. And then, again, the Christians agree and the secular liberals who hate the Christians agree. Yeah. We saw the aspect of the Old Testament in there's two aspects of it I can think of today. The Christian identity, people are like that, and real Jews, we're the real Jews, we're the real Israelites kind of thing. And in the South Africa situation with the Boers, their Christianity apparently it has that aspect to it, more of an emphasis on the Old Testament. But even in that case, I think it makes you still blind to the Jews, that you may be race aware of the blacks, as the Boers are and were, but you are, you know, basically left vulnerable to infiltration by the Jews. And that was, you know, back to what I originally said, is that about Christianity, is that it has been the vector, the method by which a back door into white societies for its whole history. Even when Europeans were focused on the Old Testament more, it's still the sprinkling of holy water, the idea that a Jew, anytime they got into trouble, could just escape through this little trap door into white society by converting, has been disastrous for European peoples for 2,000 years.
Yeah. Yeah, so don't get me wrong when I talk about some of the good aspects. There's just a handful. The Old Testament is a bunch of crap as far as I'm concerned, too. But
well, the
there
truth,
is some
yeah,
decent...
That's the decency that you're seeing is we don't need the Jews' story, though, to do that. But I think of the creativity movement. Ben Klassen basically, I think, realized that Europeans need some sort of religious feeling, that we have it sort of built into us, and yet we don't have to lie to ourselves that we are the real Israelites. We can instead do what Klassen did, which is be explicit in recognizing the Jews as enemies, and yet have our own self-worship, that we are so committed to our race that you can call that a form of religion, and take it that seriously. I mean, that's the advantage that the Jews have, that when they think of, is it good for the Jews? And the Orthodox Jews actually take their racialism to religious levels, and a religious level of commitment. That is something that whites would be better off having. It's the fact that we don't have that. We not only don't have that, we're not even conscious that we don't have it. We're not even conscious of ourselves as a race anymore.
And even in the Old Testament, when you look at the archetypes, I don't think they're good representations or to look up to. Abraham, you know, is he a good enough slave that he's going to kill his child because God asked him to? I think our ancient religions, which, you know, we don't know enough about because of the Christians, right? But, you know, you look at the Eddas or the Havamal. I'm not an expert on any of this, but from what I have read, I see for people that need this type of spirituality or religious context, I see we had it in our old religions that were far healthier, far more in line with nature. The gods that were referred to or goddesses represented traits to
emulate
courage, beauty, So I think we already had it.
Yeah, I agree. Something was lost there when Christianity took over.
But then again, with the arguments Ben Klassen made about how they weren't racial enough, those religions, it was kind of just, I think, understood. I mean, they were just talking about their own people. But, yeah, I think if we would have had creativity as a religion, let's say in early Roman times, we'd probably have the planet by now. We certainly wouldn't have a Jewish problem.
What we're lacking is consciousness, and religion is one aspect, one facet of that kind of consciousness. A collective consciousness, I mean, an awareness of who we are and what our history is. And that's something that fascinates me. I like to read about the racial history and understand the Aryans, for instance. I try and understand from the archaeological evidence, the DNA evidence. But ultimately, we have to become conscious today. That is the job before us, is to, and people talk about waking up. We need to wake up.
This is just a suggestion. You know, you probably don't want to do it, but if you ever did decide to get into writing about Christianity, I mean, you know, without pulling punches and all that, I think it would be great, because right now, at least, I'm not aware of anyone who's doing much of that, that's also a racialist. Like, there's Yukon Jack. He writes very good articles exposing various aspects of Christianity. But he's not really a racialist. So I just wish there was more people out there, or at least a few, really good at it. And I think you would be, because you make such rational arguments when you write or when you do your podcast, that, you know, maybe you could awaken some people to that. But just a suggestion, but you might not, you know, I understand it's a tough issue to deal with the struggle here.
There was a time just recently that I thought, well, I want to get into Christianity next year and focus on that in the same level of depth that I have with other subjects. And to be honest, it doesn't light my board so much. I don't have any interest in taking it apart, at least not now. I don't. But I have thought about doing it. I know it is a topic that needs to be done by a racialist and someone who's Jew-wise, and maybe I will in the future.
All right. Well, from the way I look at it, and I know Urban does as well, I think it's like it's the first and biggest propaganda weapon the Jews have used against us, and I think it's high up there, you know, number one on the list is in terms of our problems, and part of what makes us susceptible to that pathogen, or maybe that was the first pathogen. I don't know how you want to look at that, but I refer to it a lot as an infection, you know, Christ insanity infection. And I don't think we'd be in the situation we're in, you know, if Christianity hadn't infected our people. Anyway, I was going to move on here. Feminism. What are your thoughts on feminism? Do you have any ideas on the best role for women within the struggle or something along those lines?
Yeah, feminism is similar to Christianity in that it's something that I've thought about on the side, but I really don't focus on it, never have really focused on it. And it had been bothering me when I was at the White Network working side by side with Carolyn. It was an aspect of what Carolyn did that wasn't visible, I didn't think, from her work at Voice of Reason. When she focuses on National Socialist Germany, it doesn't come out. But when she talks about contemporary things, and especially her eagerness to try and get other women involved and to criticize white nationalism as a boys' club, that kind of thing, it irked me. It came across as feminist to me, as feminism. And what is feminism but a setting at odds of men and women? It's a wedge that's been driven. It's part of what the Jews have done to us, although I understand that some of it is also comes from ourselves, from white women themselves wanting to have more, and white men foolishly acceding to that and giving them a vote and so forth. It goes back before there was too much Jewish influence, too much overt Jewish influence, although the more recent feminism has been blatantly Jewish and blatantly negative and poisonous and bad for the white race. It's terrible, and I didn't like it when I saw it in Carolyn. I didn't like that attitude of, as a woman, I think this or that, because I don't feel compelled to, when I talk about things, to say, as a man, I think this or that. It's, and she didn't need to do it as a woman either. It's not like people didn't realize that someone whose company named Carolyn isn't a woman. It's implicit in what she said. But when somebody says that, it's just like when Jews say, as a Jew, I think you should do this or do that. They're trying to basically set themselves up as an authority when they do that. And I'm not saying Carolyn is a Jew. I'm just saying that that's the similarity. When a feminist says, as a woman, I think you should do this or that, they're trying to order you around and use their special view of themselves as their authority to do it. It's kind of silly. It's a bluff, really. And as far as what position they should have, I've never been sympathetic to this argument that there aren't enough women involved in pro-white this or that, that we should make an effort to involve more women, or we should soften this or that to get more women involved. It isn't for women. Policy and arguments and fights, this is men's stuff, and this is what men are supposed to do. This is what men's, it's our responsibility. We're designed for it. We're evolved for it. There's a division of labor between the sexes that goes all the way back into long before there were Europeans or Europe. It's a division of labor that involves the men being outward-facing. It's our job to defend our family and our tribes by force, if necessary, to plan, to think and strategize, to coordinate with the other men to do that, to go out and get the food and bring it home. And it's the women's job to keep the home, to raise the family, and to focus on maintaining the society, the social structure at home. And that's their role. That should still be their role today.
Well, typically, the people that call for more women within the movement or struggle are the same ones that think there won't have to at any point be anything uncomfortable, any bloodshed, just memes, let's get an organization, we're going to have huge rallies and marches and everything's going to magically get better, the Jews are going to give up power, the non-whites will disappear and everything will be wonderful. So that's why they want to bring more women into the struggle, but people that realize it's going to get physical and all that understand that, well, what are we expecting women to play our role for us? And then they'll bring up Hitler and what happened there. Well, they didn't get a lot of women on their side until they had a huge organization after lots of brawls and fighting with communists in the streets and in the pubs. It was a male thing. And later on, women came on board when there was something there of strength, which they will hear too, when we're worthy of having them come on board. But I was surprised over at Twitter, and I noticed this even with Carolyn and even Urban Jungle Girl, and I'll get your call after a couple more questions. She's on the line. A couple more questions I have for Tan here. But there's this hostility toward the basic idea of patriarchy, and some women get that from the way the Bible had things set up, which was rather hostile toward women, although some of it actually I agree with in certain parts there. But there was this hostility that you know, toward women that I would get from many passages within the Bible. So some people, you know, think that that's the only type of patriarchy, whereas if you look up the various definitions, the one that's, you know, closest in line with what I'm thinking of is just male leadership, okay? And whether it's in the family, a tribe, a city-state, a country, whatever, male leadership. And with Carolyn Yeager there, when she had Nicholson on, and he just disappeared from the internet a few months back, so I've taken most of his articles I could find, and I've got a page on the network, on the site there for his articles, which I thought were great. But he had these 6 points of what he considered people would have to agree with to really be, you know, white racialist, or if you want to say white nationalist. And one of them was understanding that the patriarchy is natural. The natural order of things. And he talked about for our race, but I would say for all of the various types of humans, or even if you want to refer to some of them as subhumans, and a lot of the mammals in general. And at first she was hostile toward that until he explained it, and then she was all right with it. And I know Urban was the same way until I clarified what I mean by patriarchy. But over on Twitter, I was connected with some women, and one of them even has a site out there, Asatru, right?
Asatru, yeah.
Yeah, one of our religions, white religions, pre-Christian times, and she's a feminist. She would talk about, no, our ancient belief, there was no patriarchy there, there was no idea of male leadership, no one was above anyone else. All these equality ideas and universal ideas, this is somebody actually having a site out there representing these beliefs, and you can just look into some of the things that have survived, and she's clearly got it wrong. I mean, they clearly did understand there's different roles for men and women, and this concept that nobody can be above anyone, what the hell? That doesn't fit anywhere in nature. So I was just shocked to find that there's people that are professing to be and probably believe they are pro-white, but they're feminists. There was two of them. I had to block them because I didn't want them in my damn feed. But they're clearly hardcore feminists, but they don't realize it.
Yeah, and it contradicts the racial awareness.
And just natural
law. Yes, and it's similar with homosexuality. It's similar with Christianity. And that feminism, homosexuality, and Christianity all have that. They're competing loyalties to your racial loyalty. And that's,
well, they said I must be a kike because only kikes believe in patriarchy. Right?
Yeah, well, the homosexuals, I'm thinking of James O'Meara now at Occidental Observer and Countercurrent, has made similar arguments that the anti-homosexual drive is coming from Jews, and that if you're against homosexuality, it's only because you're being influenced by Jews or you are a Jew. And it's a self-serving argument because he's homosexual or transsexual, whatever. And that's the same thing with women who argue feminism. They argue it not because it makes sense, not because there's any real historic argument for it, but because they think it would suit them. And they're not even honest enough to be able to say that.
See, another question I wanted to ask you. What are your thoughts in regards to the people that say we should have more pro-white rallies, marches, other types of public events, considering the situation we're in here, let's say, you know, in the United States?
Right. I'm not opposed to rallies, but I don't think it's like the meme issue. I don't think that that's going to save us. And if we were able to put on large rallies, like thinking back to the 1920s when the KKK marched, you know, had hundreds of thousands of members and marched long parades down streets in Washington, that's wonderful. It's a show of strength. It's a show of consciousness. But we don't have it. We don't have people that will come out to these things. And even on the internet, there are people who make comments that are pro-white, but for the most part, they want to stay anonymous, and they don't want to participate any more than that. Put it this way, if we had people demonstrating in the street, making large, taking days off from work to demonstrate against immigration, for instance, we wouldn't have the problems that we have if it came naturally. To try and stir that up, to agitate for it, to say the reason why we're failing is because we don't have that, is really to kind of get it backwards. We don't have those things because we're failing. We don't have those things because we don't have consciousness. And to the extent we have any consciousness, it's white people think whiteness is something bad and something to not be demonstrating in favor of.
Right. That's why I added considering the situation we're in. I speak out against the idea of these rallies, marches, various public events. But I wouldn't if they were successful, if they didn't put out the image of weakness, right? People can go out there in the dark of night and do distributions and do all sorts of things that might give an impression of more numbers than we really have. But when they get together and have a march or a rally with a couple dozen people and 1,000 people on the other side, like the last one I went to, which was more than 10 years ago, there was about 1,000 people on the other side, and we had about 70. That just, to me, puts out a sign of weakness. But, yeah, if we could get thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, sit-ins in the Capitol, shut down this city, I'd be all for it then, and then we could move beyond that. But
yeah.
So what I'm getting at is if those that want to do this can find a way to make it work, and have reasonable expectations, and there's all sorts of ways to see that. Anybody who's put one together before, you have an idea, you know, how many are going to come from past experience. Most of the people who say they're going to come aren't, right? If they can have successful ones, one part of that might be to try to, there's creative ways that you can deal with the opposition. I'm talking the One People's Project, ARA types, all those types that show up and cause trouble. That's one of the reasons whites don't want to show up, is because they know there'll be these organizations on the other side. Well, if you can find a way creatively to dampen their willingness to show up, maybe there's some consequences for them. Well, that might be one approach, but you have to find some way to get white people to show up. And if you're not going to do that, I just think people that are putting these events on are just demonstrating weakness, and they're the type that want to reach the masses, which I don't try to do at all. I'm trying to reach the reachable that Pierce talked about, that 5% or less, that have better capabilities for independent rational thought, in other words, less lemming-like. But the ones who are putting on these events or rallies, marches, they're thinking in terms of the masses, like everyone. Well, then you have to get some, then you have to demonstrate strength. You have to have numbers. That's what the masses are drawn to, not weakness.
Yeah, I like your pragmatic, practical approach to it, and also results, interested in what the results are. And the thing that also shouldn't be forgotten is, you know, when people think of demonstrations and they think of the civil rights stuff in the 60s and how all of those people in the streets, that's what changed minds and convinced the politicians to do things differently. It isn't that way. It's, you know, people like LBJ, who was the president at the time, wanted to make those changes, and he used the demonstrations more as a pretext for making the changes than as the reason that he made the changes. And so even if whites got out into the street and demonstrated, the Tea Party is a good example. Hundreds of thousands of whites did go out into the streets and do those Tea Party things, but it was peaceful. It was there was no violence, and even so, the media, probably the best thing that came out of that was that it made it pretty clear that the regime, both the media and the political leadership, is absolutely hostile to white people. And that's the lesson I took away from it, and I think a lot of other white people could see that. And the people who are still sticking with the Tea Party are Jews or other people who just do not want to get the message that their government is not stupid, it's not just uninformed or making the mistake, it's very deliberately doing what it's doing, because the people at the top want it to be the way it is, and it's right. Not going to be something that they change because 100,000 people peacefully march somewhere. 100,000 people burning down cities, that has even more of an effect. But even so, the recent things in Ferguson and Baltimore demonstrate that it's not really that the blacks are burning down cities that is actually causing our political leadership to change their minds. The political leadership is on their side. It's them at the top and the niggers at the bottom against the white middle, the cops and the white citizens.
That's why when I think about marches or rallies or any kind of public demonstrations, if we could get thousands, tens of thousands of people, maybe across the country, hundreds of thousands, but not all in one spot, different spots, but each event pretty big. Even that's not it, because we have a power structure that is against us, strongly against us. So, yeah, that's why it's different when people talk about the civil rights era and all that. There was a tripod of power, if you want to look at it that way, media, big finance, and the government, that was in favor of pushing that agenda. The blacks out in the street were just the sideshow, just part of the propaganda to appeal to white people. And the riots, some of that was white people thinking, well, let's give in to them. Let's give them what they want so that we don't have all this violence, whatever. But that was all not at the local levels, but at the federal government level and a lot of times at the state levels too, political wars. And the media, for sure. I mean, they had the support, those blacks, and even King, he had his Jewish handler. So they had full support of the power structure. We don't have any power structure support. There might be some individuals within the power structure that might support us, but I mean, in terms of like having the media on our side, the government as a whole on our side. No, we don't. So even if we could get all these people marching, that would be great, but that's not it. They will resist, and then we have to move to the next level.
Yeah. Massive resistance is another example that comes to mind, which happened before the civil rights thing. It was the reaction to the integration of the schools in 54, I think, or 55, with the Brown versus Board of Education. And the white response to that was massive resistance. And it was not just the white people, the white masses that tried to resist. It was actually state-level, local and state governments that tried to resist as well. And it was defeated ultimately because it was defeated from the top. The top had already been captured.
Right. You look even at World War I and World War II, when the federal government would open up plants or use already existing manufacturing facilities for wartime needs and start bringing in from other areas all these niggers, right? And there was white resistance, massive white resistance, violence, death, but the federal government came in with troops and crushed these whites. So it's not just getting out in the street. They're going to, you know, it's not going to be how it was with the blacks. If the blacks didn't have power structure support, if we actually had a pro-white power structure during that period, we could have crushed them easily, all right? And they would have been crushed, but they weren't crushed like we would be, or at least the attempt would be made, because they had the support of the power structure. So,
yeah, and you can trace it out how it was not complete as it is today, all the way down to the state and local level today. But even in the past, just having the federal control at the top was enough for them to suppress the resistance at the state and local levels.
Right. All right, the next one. Do you think that there's any realistic way or possibility for pro-whites to obtain real power here in the United States via, you know, the electoral political process, voting, candidates, and all that?
No. Voting is a sham. It's a cover for what we actually have, which is a plutocracy, a Judaized plutocracy. It's a way to placate the masses. It always has been, to give them the idea, the false idea, that they're participating in some way. But your vote doesn't really matter, and because they do what they want anyway, as many things that people have never even had a chance to vote on under democracy, and we get them anyway. And the media ultimately shapes what people think and how they vote anyway. And the candidates that are selected long before the election happens. So for all those reasons, it's really a losing proposition to participate in it. But the one thing it does do is provide us a platform, something that David Duke, Robert Ransdell, men like that, I respect their efforts to at least get our message out, to put up an opposition. Here's the irony, that the people who say that it's suicide, that the white race is just killing themselves, if we did nothing, if we had no leaders like Duke to point to and say, look, well, here's a guy, he tried to run, and they, you know, pulled these dirty tricks and so forth, there would be more validity to that argument that we're just killing ourselves. But there has been resistance. There have been people who have been trying all along. And the same thing about the demonstrations in the street. I won't advise people not to do that or not to participate in politics. It's not for me, and I don't think it's going to succeed. That's the answer to that question.
I always point out it's not even demographically possible for us to, you know, take control. Us, you know, I mean pro-whites, to take control of the federal government or the state government. Well, some states it would be, but the federal government, just because of the numbers, and I'll usually point out Obama won twice, even though over 60% of whites voted against him. Now, a pro-white party that the Jews, of course, are going to call, you know, racist, and I would hope it would be racist, but some might say, well, we're not racist. You know, anti-racism is just the code word for anti-white or whatever. But anything that's even slightly pro-white will be described as an evil, racist party. So it's highly unlikely that you would even get 60% of the white vote. Think more along, if it was very successful, maybe 20%, 30%. something like that. So even in that situation, you'd have to take over not just the presidency, you've got to take the Congress, right? That's not possible, okay? And then the state houses, then you've still got the courts, and it's just not something where we can, you know, take power through the political process. Things are not the same here and now as they were in Germany during that period. But, like you said, it can be used as a platform, and Glenn Miller did that a lot. He would run in local elections, and he pointed out how you can get these cheap ads because, you know, they have laws set up, you know, federal campaign laws that they have to give you the lowest priced advertising and all that if you're running a campaign. So you can get out a pro-white message. That's what I think it's very good for. And if there's ever, never has been in my area, I haven't voted in a couple decades, but if there ever was a pro-white candidate here, even though I would, you know he probably would win, I'd get up and vote for him just to build up his numbers.
Right, as a protest to show at least some disaffection with the current system. And a lot of people do that anyway, just like with the Christianity. I failed to mention this point, that not going to the churches is, they're voting with their feet, basically. They may not realize why they're not going, but they don't like what they're hearing when they go to church. And it's similar with the politics in the United States. I mean, a lot of people realize that it's pretty much hopeless and that the politicians, no matter who they vote for, are not going to give them what they want. And so they just stop participating. They don't. Most of them probably don't think about it much beyond that. They just get sick of it and leave it in disgust.
Right. And for people, I see there's a couple calls there. If you could just hold on a little longer, because I guess we're going to go longer than I thought. Are you available to keep going, Tan?
Yeah, I got
okay.
Nowhere else to go.
But I do want to get through a few more questions before we take calls, because there might be additional questions then. And so the next one I had was, do you think that there is a peaceful path to white survival in the 14 words?
No. It's not going to be peaceful. And I understood that even before I did the last 4 or 5 years of learning and understanding. It's clear that this situation didn't happen by accident, and it didn't, although we've been largely talked into it, we're not going to be able to talk our way out of it. The people who talked us into it, the fraud that's been committed, is going to result in violence if it's ever exposed to a large extent to more people. That is the natural conclusion. That's what makes the response of people when violent things do happen, where they try to distance themselves from it, demoralizing to me, discouraging to me, because it seems those people haven't thought very much about what it is that they're talking about. When they talk about white genocide, don't they realize that means violence against white people right now? That's what they're upset about. So, I think a lot of people just don't really take seriously what they themselves are saying, and they haven't thought about it.
Right.
Tolerance is suicide, as Metzger has said. And as I said earlier, that the main problem of the white race has been being too tolerant, too willing to compromise, too willing to kick the can down the road. And that's gotten us where we are. Whites show an ability for violence and for ruthless destruction of their enemies, even today. But the problem is that our targeting, the people deciding who gets targeted by our military and by our violence, are Jews. And it's for their benefit that these people go to die and fight and kill other people. It's heartening to me, though, that we do have the capacity in us, these people who say, oh, no, you know, we just want a peaceful solution or whatever, are wrong. It's not going to be peaceful, first of all, and secondly, we have the capacity to fight for ourselves brutally. We have
right,
to get our heads straight about it, that's all.
That's the hope that I have. That's what keeps me going, is my understanding that if enough of the right kind of people, it doesn't take all that many, I don't think. And that's what gives me hope, is that I do understand that our people are very creative. And so that applies to the ability to inflict violence on others as well, using technology, but even just physically, you know, even if it's hand-to-hand. I do know that our people are very much, at least some of them, enough of them, capable of very extreme violence and very effective violence if they put their mind to it, and we can get enough of them to direct that violence in the proper way, not at the enemies of the Jews, but at our enemies, starting with Jews. So,
right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's
and
right.
One way to do that is to wake them up to the fact of the fraud, that they've been lied to, and that should result in a sort of whiplash of anger about being lied to and being misled and all of the harm that's been caused and blamed on other people and other things. When it dawns on you that it's actually the Jews responsible for it, then you understand what needs to be done and what you're willing to do.
And when we talk about a peaceful path, already it's not peaceful, all right? There's already large amounts, and it's going to get a lot worse, but black-on-white violence, for example, mestizo-on-white violence. So it's already going on, and occasionally, every now and again, we get a response, like we had recently with Dylan Roof. So there's already violence. I wanted to ask you, what are your thoughts on the lone wolf, leaderless resistance, and or small cell approach?
Well, it's the only practical use of violence now, because you can't organize it. Anyone who tries is clamped down on very hard by the federal authorities. It's the best route to go for somebody who just feels like they can't control themselves and needs to do something. But that said, organization is preferable. It's what the white man does best. That's why we are so good at military things. It's our organization, and without that, we are crippled in what we can accomplish. But I think the important thing, the symbolic thing, is to do something anyway to fight back in some way, to not go down just because we can't organize. No excuses. No, you know, I ran out of ammunition. Well, so pick up a rock and throw it. You know, whatever. And just do what you can. That's the angle that I see that from.
Well, there's leaderless resistance, but I also mentioned small cell approach, or even, let's say, organizations beyond the small cell. There's possibilities for organizations that purport to be one thing but are really involved in something else. In other words, there's ways to organize more low-key where you could be involved in things that might not be illegal or violent or anything like that, but are still preparing for various forms of resistance that, if the Jews were aware of them, they're going to do what they need to do, and it's not all that difficult to destroy that organization. They've done it over and over again. So
yes,
even when it comes to organizations or even small cells, there's ways to, that's, you know, a small organization, there's ways to organize that don't necessarily have to be, let's say, the big V or the big T, although down the road, I don't see any way around that, but I just wanted to point that out. Just maybe briefly give me some thoughts. Going forward from where we're at right now, what do you think is the best path to take or the best approach for securing an existence for our people and a future for white children?
Step one is to realize that and to realize the significance and the importance of an idea like that, that that is the basis of a morality. That is all that needs to be said, really. And that should be the basis of every argument that white people have about everything, is that how do we answer that question, or the specific question that we're trying to deal with at any given time, how does it best answer that basic premise? And that should be the basic premise. And slogans, you know, some people they bristle at the idea of slogans, whether it's the 14 words or things like with Jews you lose, or if it ain't white, it ain't right, things like that. But those really are
like all
a good way to encapsulate things, to keep it around blacks, never relax. Those kind of things are valuable because they are so easy to remember and so easy to pass on, so easy to share with people.
And every one of the ones you just mentioned, I'd say is pretty accurate. I mean, you could argue about, what was the one you said, it ain't
white. If it ain't white, it ain't right.
You know, maybe you could get into, well, what about white race traitors? But as far as the other ones, you know, around blacks, never relax, that's a pretty damn good idea. The 14 words is something to strive for, or the way the creativity religion put it was, what's good for the white race is of the ultimate virtue, and what's bad for the white race is the ultimate sin. So yeah, these memes that express very good points. I think they're good.
Well, that's how we go forward, to make white people think in those terms, to show them by example that's how you can think and that you can get things done that way. That it brings a coherence to everything else that happens if you use that as your basis.
What I don't like, you know, sometimes on the other side they'll say, oh, these nationalists or racialists or, you know, people call themselves different things, or just pro-white people, they're just, you know, parroting this and that. Well, that's what people do. I mean, Klassen would say something along the lines of, I don't need to reinvent the wheel. If somebody's already said something that makes a good point and worded it very well, I don't need to come up with another way to say it. So what matters to me is that you understand the meme or the quote or whatever it is that you're expressing. You really understand it, and it's sensible.
Yeah.
Which is not the case, the stuff we hear from the left that they're parroting, or just in general, I don't care if it's from the left, right, you know, that we're getting from the Jews. It's nonsensical stuff, just garbage.
That's right. Yeah, and it works even when it's nonsense. Like, diversity is our greatest strength.
Yeah.
People will parrot that, and it has a disastrous effect. Even though it's untrue, even though it has a disastrous effect, people still parrot it, and that's why it's effective.
But there are some pro-whites out there that don't really understand their memes. I used to run across this a lot on YouTube in the comments to various videos, and, you know, about anti-racism is code for anti-white. And I actually like that one. Some people don't. But then, you know, the anti-racist types, or I would just say anti-white types, they would say, well, if that's so, well, that means that racism is code for white. And then these people would be stumped, when actually he's right. But we're trying to point out that those that say they're anti-racist focused all their energy only on whites, on white supposed racism, and they don't pay any attention to the other racial groups that are fiercely racist. So therefore, when they say racist, they mean white. So that's how you should respond to that. So only maybe word it better. But most of them are stumped when they get that. They'll say, no, it doesn't mean that. Well, it does. The guy's reversing it properly. And so some of them don't really understand their meme. They're just parroting it without a full understanding of the implications of it. What are your thoughts on the recent reprisal killings? And I believe I got that term from you, correct me if I'm wrong, that Dylann Roof is accused of committing, and the manner in which most white racial leaders have responded to those reprisal killings.
I thought I got reprisal from you, but I agree with that.
I think I said revenge. Reprisal's better.
It is, and that's what it is. At least if we take at face value that Roof was the one, that he actually did what he's described to do, that this manifesto that he wrote is actually his, and that what he said, you know, about you're raping our women and you have to go, you're taking over our country and you have to go, that all is true. If that is all true, then Dylann Roof, what he did is a reaction, it's a response to what's been done to whites. And that ought to be the pro-white attitude about it. Just instinctively, first of all, you should always think about defending anyone who's white, no matter what they do. And that's something that intellects, especially white intellects, can't seem to get their brains around. You know, they try to ridicule that idea. Think about, in the past I've talked about that, how people would make fun of nationalism or racialism as, you know, only weak people who don't have any accomplishments of their own latch on to the accomplishments of the group, you know, that kind of attack on such beliefs. But it's really... A group loyalty is something that's healthy and normal to have, and to come to the defense of anyone in your group who's attacked. The difference between the case that the Boer described in South Africa, Baron Strydom, and how his family did not disown him, didn't condemn him, but instead defended him and called him a hero. And the contrast with Roof and how his own family disowned him and said one of his uncles said he would push the button himself. And this is before the a trial had even occurred, before anybody knew any of the details. And that was the doubly dismaying thing about some of the pro-whites, the way they reacted so quickly. It was like they were trying to beat the anti-whites and the Jews to the punch, to disown their own guy first before anybody else could, so that they could get some sort of, I don't know, the analogy I thought of at the time is a shit sandwich. They thought they had to answer with a shit sandwich, and the shit sandwich was that they had this point that they wanted to agree with. What Ruth wrote in his manifesto did describe the ideas that they share, and most of them, to their credit at least, said as much. They said, oh, he wrote some good stuff, it's accurate, it's right. But then they tried to wrap that, usually literally, by introducing what they were writing with a condemnation of Ruth and some expression of sympathy for the niggers that were killed. And then at the end, they'd conclude with that as well. So that's what I mean by a shit sandwich. But the thing is that they thought that the shit was the middle part, and they thought that the pieces of bread that they were using to soften the shit was those disclaimers to admit, so that they wouldn't look bad saying nice things about the dead niggers or how they were condemning Ruth. The exact opposite from a truly pro-white point of view is the case. First of all, they could have done without those pieces of bread in the beginning and the end. And if they simply had taken those out, left those parts out, and only talked about the poisonous Jewish media influence and how that caused Ruth to do what he did, and that Ruth is right, what he wrote in that manifesto, if it's him, he's right about that. That's all they needed to say. They could have left out the other part. So the reality of their shit sandwich was the opposite of what they thought that they, I think, what they thought they were doing. They actually added two pieces of shit on the outside of what was otherwise a positive message, and they could have left those parts out. That's the sad thing about what so many of them did.
And of course, the way the Jewish media is reacting to this reprisal killing is exactly what led to these killings. They're doing the same thing that, you know, if we go with what he wrote in his manifesto as being legit, it's what angered him, was all this black-on-white crime being ignored and the focus being on these unusual white on, let's say, black or other race. So they're doing the same thing, you know, pushing this anti-white narrative in how they report this story that
yes.
kind of led to and will lead to more of these kind of reprisal killings. So
it's more than just the hiding the black crime, the black-on-white violence. That's just one aspect of what the
right.
Jewish media does and what they distort. It's basically like the Boer said, that the whole narrative is anti-white. No matter what happens, if it's blacks doing something bad, it's blamed on whites and white racism. If whites do something bad, it's blamed on whites and white racism. And it's that it is that way because it's a Jewish media, because the Jews run it, and it's their narrative that we're hearing.
And I think for some of the people that are in various types of leadership positions, I think some of them felt a need to express sympathy for the victims, even say things like, you know, this wasn't wise because these are innocent people. These were the better blacks. I think part of that gets back to Christianity is because some of these people are heavily infected, and this was in a church. But clearly these individuals, I mean, you can argue about whether this was wise or this or that. They weren't innocents. These were individuals that were involved heavily in the anti-white agenda. I mean,
yeah.
These were individuals involved in the Black Lives Matter movement, which is a movement designed to incite violence by blacks and maybe others as well against whites and create or cement more of this perverse white guilt. So, I mean, these people were not what I would refer to as innocents. They were politically active individuals, movers and shakers in that area. So I don't see them as innocents.
Yeah, well, the people who condemned him, the pro-whites who condemned him, called, you know, said he was crazy. And they said that his, as an example of his insanity, was the fact that he picked this church, which just was senseless, to kill niggers in this church, the worst target you could have picked. And what they didn't even think of is the significance of that church, the historic significance
right.
of that church, and what those people had been up to in that church, even in the recent past. That it's basically a black headquarters,
right,
for racial aggression against whites. So,
some of these people are, you know, because of their Christianity, they're of the sort, and some of them, I'm not going to name names, have said so recently, others way back when I first got involved, they have this attitude that they would rather affiliate with or be friendly with a black person that's a Christian than a pro-white person who's not. There is that attitude out there. And one individual is kind of well known and made statements like that recently, and then he rescinded them, but I believe they represent his true feelings. So I think the church thing, I don't know, weighed on some people, but I think for some people, no matter what, they'll always say, well, why not this, why not that? No matter what happens, why not this target, that target? There are, you know, people that are just always going to condemn any reprisals from our side.
Yeah, I think it's a valid point. By the way, Kevin Alfred Strom actually gave an explicit or more explicit example or suggestion. He didn't just say, well, he could have picked a better target. He said, well, it should have been three politicians and three media moguls and three university professors or something. And that's a more of a proper criticism of it from a white point of view, from a pro-white point of view. If you're going to say that Ruth did something wrong, it's that he didn't do it right enough. He didn't do it well enough. He could have picked a better target. And then give a specific what you think would have been a better target.
I was kind of surprised that he took that stance. And in fact, you know, I've been involved maybe like, 15 years now. I was always somewhat racist, but I'd say fully racially aware of what's going on in Jew-wise. You know, so there's been other incidents during these times, and I was kind of surprised that we are at least getting more closer to what I think is a better response from some of the white racial leaders out there than in the past. And also in comment sections to articles and at YouTube videos, I noticed, and a lot of this is just coming from Joes and Sallys. You can just tell because there's so much of it and they don't seem to be aware. You know, they don't seem to be fully racially aware based on some of the things they're saying or aware of the Jews and stuff. But I was reading a lot of comments that were clearly coming from whites that are just fed up and, you know, were pointing out, well, what about all this black-on-white crime? And, you know, kind of defending Dylan in a way. And I think, now I don't have TV, but from people I know who do and from what I see on the Internet, even my feed from my Internet service provider, already within 5 days it wasn't a top story. And you'd go to the thing and click what they're showing as headlines, and it wasn't there anymore. And in my local paper, 3 days later, it wasn't anymore. I think the way the Jews were playing this, maybe it wasn't working so well for them. Maybe they were surprised at some of the responses they're getting. They don't seem to be making it. I mean, they made a big deal about it, yeah, but
it wasn't getting any traction. I agree. The ordinary people around me in my life that I talked to were not sympathetic to the blacks. And especially after this last year's worth of nonsense that's been going on, Ferguson demonstrated that even if Dylan Roof was a cop with the authority to pull the trigger and had pulled the trigger on a thug, you know, a black thug in the middle of committing a crime, that we saw already what the reaction to that was from the blacks. That was considered an illegitimate target even, that cop, what was his name, whatever, in Ferguson, that was considered wrong, what he did. And the niggers burned down Ferguson as a response. But they haven't burned down Charleston. And to me, I think that the blacks have been put back on their heels by this reprisal, that they are actually afraid that if more whites start thinking like Dylan Roof and start acting like Dylan Roof, that they're going to be in for trouble. And so they're actually not burning down cities in response to this.
Right. I think the way that the Jews have played certain incidents over the last couple of years, starting with Trayvon, and well, they've done this for decades, but I mean, especially over the last couple of years with that Trayvon and then the gentle giant you were referring to, that they say, gentle giant and all that, I don't think it's been working too well for them because these aren't cases that the typical white Joe and Sally would be sympathetic to the blacks involved. But I consider there might be another aspect to this in play, because otherwise we could just think, well, the Jews are fucking up here, and they're not perfect. They do make mistakes, but there could also be what I think is a possibility that they don't necessarily always pick the best cases. We had a local case in my area of a black that was shot 17 times by a cop, that would have been a much more sympathetic case instead of with this supposed gentle giant charging at the cops and the autopsy later and other things showing that, you know, it wasn't hands up, it wasn't in the back. You know, this wasn't the greatest case. There are some others out there that, I mean, they don't have many good cases, but there are some out there that they could focus on that might play better to get more of that white guilt going and so forth. But I think that they're trying to just get whites more supportive of the police state. That's what I think it's about, so that they don't bring up the best cases, so that whites aren't sympathizing with the blacks. They're sympathizing not in a racial way necessarily with whites, although I think some of that's coming in, and that's why the Jews are screwing up. But they're trying to, I think, getting them to just support cops, so that as they increase this police state, whites will just be more supportive of it, not realizing it's there to protect, I think, the mud people and the Jews from us.
Yeah,
and they want to build it up more to use it against us.
Yeah, it did seem odd to me that the Jews seem to be very deliberately trying to undermine the police that protect them. And why would they do that? And as you say, it could be because they want whites to lend more support to the police. I think it's basically a sign that you know, that they're not picking good cases to focus on. They're not all powerful. They don't do everything perfectly. And sometimes situations get out of their hands. I take issue with these people, for instance, that think that the whole Dylann Roof thing was just a complete crisis actors and it was all make-believe. It totally fabricated, that it didn't really happen. I think that that's escapism, really. They're trying to basically write it off and so that they don't have to deal with the violence, with the consequences.
Is there anything you want to say about Anders Breivik and the blow that he struck against the elites there in Norway?
Well, I wrote a blog post about it. I was glad that you brought it up again after so many years, and he's been in jail for a while now. When I covered it initially, I was pretty neutral about it. I took my own advice that I'm trying to give to people about Dylann Roof, is that if you don't have to support the guy, but you don't need to condemn him either. And it was after hearing what Alex Linder had to say about him and hearing what you had to say about him that I, and other sources that I had heard over the intervening years and my own thinking about it, that basically I think he did pick the right target. A lot of people said he was crazy, that he picked the wrong target, he should have attacked somebody else. But ultimately, it is those traitors in his country that he attacked, them and their children. And the idea was to intimidate those people. And I think it had the effect that it was intended to have. Now, the one thing he wanted was to have more of it. He wanted to inspire other people to rise up and do the same thing. And that hasn't happened. But I think overall, it certainly isn't any worse in Norway than it would have been if he hadn't done what he did. And that's usually the way I phrase it is, you know, do you think white people would be better off with zero Breiviks, zero Dylann Roofs, or more of them? And if we had more of a willingness to strike and punish the people who actually are responsible for doing this harm, wouldn't that do something? Wouldn't it have an effect? Wouldn't it actually be good for us if we did?
Well, I think if you had a couple dozen of them, and it might be far less than that, just in that small country, population-wise there, that would have pretty much brought about very big changes. You know, people were saying, well, why not hit a mosque, or why not this? The elites in that country, and I'm talking about the white traders, right? And there was Jews involved there, too, on that island. One of them was a Jewish woman that was giving a little talk there to the young men and women, you know, filling their head full of white guilt. But anyway, these elites, they don't give a shit about Muslims. They don't give a shit about a mosque being hit. That doesn't bring any consequences to them for their treasonous activity. They don't care about that, but they do care about themselves and their family. I don't know what more perfectly described terrorism than what went on there. And some people think, well, terrorism is bad, and I guess it depends on who does it, according to the typical yokels out there, you know. Everyone else is the terrorist. The Muslims are terrorists. But when we bomb, by we, I mean not we, when the United States enemy military bombs a wedding party, killing men, women, and children, well, that's not terrorism because we're the good guys. But in any case, those who understand what terrorism really is, that was true terror. I mean, how can you terrify people more than hitting where it matters most, their own families? Okay, they care about their children. I don't think they do enough long term, or they wouldn't be on the path they're on. They're not thinking big picture long term of the hell that they're going to make for their children, grandchildren, and so forth. But still, hit at people's family, I mean, that is a direct consequence for their activities, and it's going to scare the shit out of them. And if you had more Breiviks in that country, those elites would change their damn course or head for the exits or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, that captures it.
All right, is there anything you want to say? Well, maybe we've already covered this in regards to the general topic of political violence.
Violence works. The people who say that violence doesn't work, you just made the point. You know, what the government does is not usually called terrorism or violence, but those people who are making the decisions that allow their countries to be overrun, to be flooded with hostile aliens, all of the murders, all of the rapes, all of the violence, including the Breiviks attacks, are all on their heads. They're the ones who created the situation. They're the ones responsible for it.
All right. Was there anything else that you wanted to touch on?
Oh, lots of things.
See if I got calls.
Let's take the calls.
Okay. Let me give this one a shot. Caller, give me your name or handle and let me know what you have to say, perhaps a question for Tan.
Yes, this is Racist, otherwise known as AP. I was calling because I was curious if Tan Stoffel knew of any articles about European countries that were similar to the work that Kevin McDonald did on the Jewish involvement in shaping American immigration policy. Any similar works like that in the movement in regards to European countries?
You mean the PDF that he wrote that really traced from the 1880s to the 1960s, the Jewish involvement in immigration? I don't know of any directly, but there have been a few articles on his site just in the last year about Britain and the influence that the Jews had over the immigration into Britain. And you can Google Barbara Roche, I think R-O-C-H-E, is the Jewish minister or somebody who was, and Andrew Nether, who I don't think is a Jew, but was part of the Liberal or Labor Party over there, exposed the recent involvement in opening the borders, the most recent flood. But as far as going back to in Britain, it was back in the 1960s where I think the Windrush came in 1948 and then it got really bad in the 1960s. But the Jews, I'm sure, were involved in that all along because the Jews were in charge of that country effectively as far back as the British Empire. And those wars were waged on behalf of, and the colonialism was done on behalf of the Jews who were funding it and calling the shots about it. So, of course, they controlled the immigration into that country in the last century. But I don't know if anybody's actually detailed it out, certainly not in the level that Kevin McDonald has in that PDF, that chapter. I think it's a chapter from one of his books in his trilogy. But that is an excellent reference work that I always send that URL to people, tweet it out occasionally to remind them about it. And we could use equivalents for Britain, for France, for Germany, and so forth.
Okay, and then in terms of your shows, I was curious, maybe you don't know off the top of your head, but what period have you gone into the specific names of Jewish leaders and the power structure? I find that to be an interesting topic, you know, especially the bankers that are behind the IMF and the IMF themselves. I think it's important to discuss concrete information about the Jews that are...
Well, I agree with you. Naming names and being specific about, you know, instead of just saying it's the Jews, but giving specific names and dates and details are important. But I've never done anything comprehensive on the power structure. It's something that I have toyed with the idea of doing something focused on organized Jewry, just trying to spell out all of the different organizations and so forth. But there's a website dedicated to that. I forget what it's called now off the top of my head, but focuses on the treasury and the various aspects of our regime and analyzes the individuals at the top to see which ones are Jews, which ones are married to Jews, and so forth. And that's an excellent website. And I can't recall off the top of my head what it is. Who runs Wall Street? Who runs the Fed? Who runs, you know, all these different aspects of our society?
And then there's that old, it's outdated, but Who Rules America from Pierce. That was good.
Oh, right. Who Rules America, yeah. Yeah, that's a good one, too. And Nick Griffin wrote one decades ago now. I think it was probably 20 years ago. The Mind Benders. He wrote it anonymously and has since, you know, softened his attitude about race and the Jews. But that's another classic work to read about the media, specifically in Britain.
And one of the many things I liked about Pierce was how he understood the importance of the media. He even described it as being more deadly than nuclear weapons. When we think of the media, and by media, I don't just mean buildings, I mean the people. And I don't just mean those who are the CEOs and the board of directors and the various other management. Obviously, you know, they play more of an important role. But I mean all the way down the line to the editors and the people who write articles, the talking heads on TV. These individuals are what I consider, and he did as well, to be the most serious enemies of our race, whether they're Jews, you know, black or white race traders. These are the people, and I include academia as another branch of media because they're pushing anti-white propaganda as well. But these are the people that are pushing this anti-white agenda. They wouldn't be able to get anywhere without the media.
Yeah, I agree.
Anything else there, caller? What were you going by now, racist?
Yeah, that's how I host Eugenic Anarchy. Right. Well, I did want to know if Ton Stoffel had any ideas or a particular point of view in regards to white community building and what's the best approach, and of course, particularly in this country, America.
Yeah, I don't have any strong opinions about it. I know for myself, when I decided to leave California because it was falling apart and turning non-white, I looked around the country and I was surprised to find just how far gone every place was. It wasn't just California. Somewhere in the back of my mind, I had always thought, well, you know, things are really terrible here, but they must still be okay in other places. But I did find a nice place that's in the mountains of North Carolina. It's country. It's not very heavily populated. There's almost no non-whites. It's safe, healthy living, but it's not a pro-white community like it is in, say, Kalispell or the Project Little Europe type places out west or Northwest Front or anything. I liked that podcast that you did, Bill, a couple of months ago now, where you debated the whole issue, but I don't have any strong feelings on it myself one way or the other.
Yeah, that was Mike, the caller. Sometimes he referred to himself as Tinfoil Hat Mike, but he was promoting Kalispell and other ideas of, you know, just anywhere trying to get these communities going. And I was pretty hostile toward it initially, but just the way he explained it, you know, because I would think along the lines of, well, we can't all get in one, which was kind of foolish, can't all get in one place that makes an easy target. Well, not everyone's going to do that, but the more communities we could have like that, well, he just made very good arguments that changed my view on it to where I now understand that's fine. I was never, like, totally hostile, but I had a knee-jerk reaction to that kind of idea that it's just some way of trying to find a a way out of the mess where we're not going to have to fight. But the way Mike described it, not necessarily those are good places to fight from. Right?
Yeah. So, and also it's a way to survive. I mean, that rather than trying to maintain your apartment in the middle of Miami or something, just out of principle, it's dangerous and better to get out of there and live to fight another day than or go out in a blaze of glory if that's what you're going to do, you know, but then do it. Don't just hang on by your fingernails there. That
some people, they don't realize it, but they're just trying to make excuses. They'll say something along the lines of, well, we're done running. We need to stand our ground. And, well, it depends on where you're at, though. If you're in an area that's, you know, loaded with non-whites, I mean, you've got to look at it. Is it defensible? Is it a city where you're dependent on goods being brought in and all that, where you don't have ability of growing your own food, raising some animals? So, you know, it makes more sense to me to get to somewhere defensible, because they'll point out, oh, they can drop Somalians everywhere. Yeah, they could, but it's better to be in a situation that's overwhelmingly white when that happens than somewhere that's already gone. So
yeah.
I think some people look at that idea that they're dropping Somalians or Mexicans or, you know, moving them all over anyway, trying to ruin every white community as an excuse not to do what they need to do to get to a more defensible position and then stand your ground. There's another caller here. Let me take this. Caller, give me your name or handle if you'd like. You don't need to, but then just let me know what you have to say.
Hi. I was just simply a question for Tan Soffel about what you see in the future for countries like France that has accepted millions upon millions of Asians. Like, we constantly hear about Muslims, but we don't really hear about what the Chinese and what even East Indian Hindus and Sikhs think of white people and how they generally support us or are against us. I was just wondering your viewpoint.
Well, my view about that, even outside of France or Europe, is that it's deluded to think that, as some whites do, that Asians are less objectionable. They're just as alien, and if anything, they're more of a threat because they are more capable. The blacks are fairly easily dealt with, assuming we actually have control over our own power structure, our own military. But the Asians are not so easily managed, and I see violence and I see bloodshed in the future of all of the places where non-whites have been allowed to invade white living spaces, and that's in the future. The question is whether it's going to be whites inflicting that violence or whether whites are going to be the ones that are on the receiving end of it. So far, it's whites on the receiving end, and whites and the police force trying to keep the races apart or quell the violence to a certain extent. But this is not going to go on forever like this.
The focus in Europe just on the Muslims.
Mm.
I see these videos on YouTube and cities in Italy with all these Chinese, right? And then, of course, we know that some of the Nigerians, for example, coming into various European countries are Christians. Do I care? Does that mean they're okay? So, you know, this focus just on Muslims rather than on, and then, you know, they're not focusing on race then, right? They're focusing on religion instead of focusing on non-whites coming into Europe, you know. And again, the Jews seem to be playing this because some of these groups are actually allying themselves with Jews and Israel to fight the, you know, the Muslims. And how do I know that down the road that might be the one group that they won't mind? They brought them in, you know, they were behind it, but that they won't mind maybe cleansing them later, you know, as if that's going to solve the problem. I understand they have more of a Muslim problem in Europe than here, but there's still tens of millions of these other non-whites in Europe that aren't Muslims.
Yeah. The problem is they're not us, and that's what the argument should be, not they have a primitive religion or they're violent or anything like that. It should just be they're not us, and they can't be us, and if we blend with them, we're not going to be us anymore. And unfortunately, the Jews are the first aliens in Europe and have been in Europe for 2,000 years, softening Europeans up to this. And this is really, we're getting to the end game now in Europe with the, it's not just Muslims anymore, as you say, it's Asians, and boatfuls of Africans now are flooding in as well. But the focus on one particular group is, we have a similar situation in the U.S. When I was in the Southwest, it was Mexicans. Mexicans were visible, they were the obvious problem. And I could see from communicating with other people on the other side of the country that they thought blacks were the problem. If you live in the Southeast, then you think it's blacks that are the problem. If you live in one of the big cities, maybe it's Asians that you complain about. But that is kind of a distraction. It's sort of like the standard politics and the left-right conservative-liberal food fight that's going on. Being distracted to just be against Muslims or just be against Mexicans or just be against Asians is wrong. It's getting distracted by the details rather than seeing the problem clearly, which is that they're not us, and that's the true objection. That's the true basis for an objection. You may argue then about, well, who is us? Who are white people anyway? But that's a good argument to have. That's certainly a more productive argument than, you know, well, you're just a racist for not wanting the Muslims around or whatever other circle jerk distraction that you get into with those kind of arguments. Or the people who say, well, the Asians work out fine. And,
Are you connected on Twitter to the guy, White Family at Have White Kids, I think it is?
Yeah, I was following him for a little while, but I couldn't take it. I mean, he's a little bit too harsh and too unsympathetic to other whites. I know he's more.
I've done entire podcasts on him on reading the tweets.
Well, he's got some good things, and I understand his point of view, but he just comes across as somebody who's got a very negative attitude about his race. It's it kind of puts me off. I mean, even Linder at times when he talks about, I don't love my race. You know, what should I love about it? There's this and that to hate or to not like. And he's, you know, his criticisms are valid, but it's, I don't know. It kind of
there's different. Well, there's different audiences. You know, some people are trying to use ridicule because it works on certain types of people to get them to toughen up. And it depends on who you're trying to reach. If you're focusing a larger net out there, well, then you're going to have a different approach. But if you're trying to focus on people that are already calling themselves racially aware, Jew-wise and all that, then you have some different tactics that you might take. Because I've had some podcasts that you might not like. Sometimes I have went pretty negative on white people. But I'm dealing with people mostly that are already racially aware, and I'm just trying to...
Right, and it comes across when you do it that where you're coming from and where your heart is, so I'm not put off by it when you do it. My attitude and my aim, I usually try to talk to my podcast audience or write to basically how I would talk to my neighbors about the problem or how I would talk to who aren't racialists or Jew aware. And I try to use plain language and simple analogies and simple arguments that would appeal and make sense even to them. Sometimes, you know, I don't like the inside baseball type stuff where you make references to things and you assume that everybody already knows what you're talking about. I like to fully link what I'm talking about so that anybody who doesn't already understand the background can go and find it out for themselves if they're curious. So sometimes I may come across to people as being too elementary or too dumbed down or too simplified, but that's why, because I'm trying to pull along more people who aren't up to speed yet.
Well, I don't think your stuff is dumbed down. Well, I get
what
you're saying, though. You know, you're explaining it and all that, but what I've read there and then listening to your podcast, it's very rational. You know, you'll set out premises and then you'll back them up, you know.
Yeah.
Let's say moving beyond, what would they say in logic terms, moving beyond valid arguments to sound arguments, you know. And but even when they're valid, you know, if your premises are correct, that means your conclusions would be correct. But then a lot of times you make it clear, you know, with the evidence there that your premises are correct. So therefore, you know, that would be the soundness moving beyond validity. But anyway, there's other issues that you've kind of swayed me on. That's why I wanted to have you on, because I'd like to interview Linder, actually, too, because I'm not all that clear. I haven't heard many times. He's been interviewed once by Carolyn Yeager there when he talks about this head that he's trying to build, a white head like for the body. What I'm getting at is I'm not clear where he comes from in a whole bunch of areas. But most of what I have heard from him, in fact, he's the one who awakened me to this Breivik situation, you know, and he was writing about it shortly thereafter.
What's amazing about Linder's take on it is he had that take the day after the attack happened. He was already basically coming out in defense of Breivik, saying it was understandable what happened, that it was a blow struck against our enemies. You know, basically what took me months or years to eventually come to understand myself, and only probably because I heard him say it. And that's the importance of us speaking truths, is exactly that, that the people who hear it, they need to hear it. That not everybody can figure this stuff out, and it helps tremendously to hear people simply enunciate certain basic things, things I think are simple or something. You know, I'm amazed sometimes that people say, oh, yeah, they quote that particular part and say, oh, yeah, this is exactly right. And I think to myself, well, it's pretty obvious. I thought it was obvious. But that's the value of just saying things, talking about these things. You talk to Linder, get in touch with him on Twitter. Team White versus Team Jew. And one point that he makes, which I couldn't agree with more, is the biggest problem with white people is we undersimplify. we don't simplify enough. You know, we overcomplexify, especially when he's talking about intellectuals, whether it's McDonald or Greg Johnson or people like that, that try to make it more complicated than it really is. And it isn't. I mean, there's all sorts of little nooks and crannies and nuances you can get lost in, but the problem is pretty straightforward. Whites versus Jews is what it boils down to.
Yeah, I retweet quite a few of his tweets, and when I've heard him or read stuff from him, I'm usually pretty much in agreement. So I would really like to pick his brains, because there's a whole bunch of things I don't know where he's coming from, because maybe he's written about it, but I just, you know, haven't read it, or maybe he's done podcasts. But I'd like to understand, you know, what is his philosophy on some of these things? What is he trying to do with this Team White and all that? But I haven't read anything in depth. I don't fully understand. So I'll give it a shot. I get the impression he might think we're a little bit too lowbrow over here. But then again, he could come over and raise us up.
No, I've never gotten that attitude from Linder that he looks down at other people for not being smart enough or not being clever enough or whatever. He's actually comes across as a very humble guy. He's just he's rude. He's balls out, you know, whatever, says what's on his mind, even when it's negative and critical, but it's not from an elitist or snobbish point of view at all.
Well, I've always liked the guy. I mean, I don't know him personally, but from what I've, you know, heard, any time he's been interviewed that I've caught. Anyhow, this caller here, was there anything else you wanted to say?
Yeah, I was interested in the similarities between Islam and Judaism, is because we hear, I've been hearing a lot from Muslims that sound eerily similar to what you say, and we know, and I know the fact that both these people are Semitic, and both stem from the Middle East, and both these people sound similar, where they're against nationalism and against racial purity. And this is what led me to the Jewish question, is because after 9/11, I didn't really know much about either of these people. And that's what led me to find out about Jews, is because I was wondering why Europe was being flooded with Muslims. And the more I read about their history, especially Al-Andalus, and more about these people's genetic history, and they're very similar to each other. And both of them, especially Muslims, tried to spend 1,400 years to eradicate Europe genetically and linguistically and wipe us off the map.
Before you answer that, I want to point out, like, when people think about ISIS now and what they're doing and destroying some historic sites and all that, think back, okay, during the Dark Ages, who were the ones that are doing, like, what some of the radical Muslims are today? It was the Christians destroying our, by our, I mean white people's history, our roots, just burning libraries, going after anyone who wouldn't jump on board with Christ insanity. So the Christians of old were very much like the radical Muslims today. But go ahead, Tan, if you want to address.
Yeah, there are similarities. I've thought about sometimes about doing a podcast or a post about some of the basic things, like the fact that they have a moral system that involves telling the truth to their own kind but lying to outsiders. The Muslims call it taqiyya, and I forget what the Jews call it, but that they have kosher food versus, and the Muslims have halal, the circumcision thing. There's a lot of different parallels, and there's some speculation that even Islam is basically a Jewish creation, or at least was given, was what do they call that, midwived by Jews. And that they got along very well with each other in Al-Andalus in Spain. That the, in fact, it's, the Jews call it their golden age. If you go and Google Jewish golden age, you find out it's Jews working together with the Muslims in conquered Spain before the Reconquista, and when the Spaniards were able to retake their country and push out the Jews and the Muslims. In fact, what Europeans are taught about that period of history is that that led to the Spanish Inquisition and how bad and evil that was. But what it was about was removing the last vestiges of the Jewish and Muslim influence in Spain, and about rooting out the disloyal Jews that were still sticking around, refused to leave. So there are similarities between Islam and Christianity. The universalism is one, that if you convert to their religion and they accept anyone to convert, that you're treated as a brother, as an equal.
All right. Did you have anything else?
No, I'm good. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for calling. Okay. Let me try this other one. All right, caller, give me your name or handle.
Well, my name's Chris Taylor. I comment quite frequently on Tan's blog. I just wanted to call in and tell Tan that he does a great job, and I appreciate his blog. And, Bill, I appreciate your podcast, and you guys do really good work.
Thank you, Chris. It's good to hear your voice.
Yeah, man, I know I've lurked on your forum for quite a while now, but, yeah, man, some of your stuff, the genocide, suicide stuff, is really helped me out a lot to kind of – because I was victim to that suicide thing for a while where I was just committing suicide. And then I started reading your blog, and it kind of started to make more sense that suicide doesn't really quite capture what's going on. And so I wanted to thank you for that, to get me out of that. I was kind of stuck in that teacher, Greg Johnson, monomaniac, monocausalism mindset for quite a while. And I've come out the other end, and so I appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome. I'm glad I helped.
Yeah, man, anyway, I don't want to take up too much time. I know you guys have been talking for a while, so I just wanted to call in, and I missed you when you were on Renegade. I just wanted to call in and say I appreciate your blog and your podcast, and Bill, you do great work at the Might is Right, and that's pretty much all I got to say.
All right, thanks.
All right, guys, take it easy. Bye.
That's humbling, and I like feedback like that. Well, the next step after the genocide-suicide thing, you convince some people that it's genocide, then the next line of defense is, well, you're a monocausalist, or you're a monomaniac, and you're obsessed with the Jews, and you just want to blame everything on the Jews. And I think it's a bizarre line of argument, because what I'm really trying to do is keep everything from being blamed just on white people, so that they lose sight of the enemy and say that there is an enemy, which means that there's two parties in this. And to be called a monomaniac for wanting to expand the topic to two parties is kind of bizarre, but that's what comes next after the genocide-suicide thing.
I don't get this from you, but I do sometimes get irritated at some people where I might be thinking, or maybe even have said, I think so on air, that some people do try to go too far where everything's the Jews, and a lot of it pretty much is the Jews, okay? I think they're the number one enemy, but I like to point out that, you know, white race traders, that they couldn't really get anywhere without that, okay? Most whites don't know, so if they're committing treason, it's unknowingly. But I'm talking about the ones who do, the big shots, yeah, you know, that are going along with the Jews. Well, they're the enemy within, okay? And that's obviously a problem. I mean, you can't effectively deal with the enemy outside if you don't deal with the enemy within. So sometimes I get irritated with some people that make excuses for the serious white race traders. And oh, it's all juju. But I never got that from you. It's clear to me when you're pointing these things out that you're making it clear that we have this external enemy, right?
Yeah.
And even when we talk about the white race traders, it is this external enemy that is utilizing these white race traders against us.
That's right. That's the role. That's who they're betraying us to, and that's important.
Right. See if Norm here has anything else to say.
I look forward to checking out your material, and if you can tell Bill what that site was with the specific names of the people in the power structure. I know he can put that in afterwards. I think that's an important thing to focus on, is the specific people who are in power.
Yeah, I'll dig it up. Yeah,
all right, thank you.
Yeah, sure thing.
All right, thanks. All right, any final thoughts?
No, I'm topped out, Bill, but it's been very good talking to you, and I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, and I appreciate it, so I'll let you go. I know I've taken a lot of your time. Thanks again, and enjoy the rest of your evening.
You too.
All right, take care. Thanks to Tan. I really appreciate him being here. Thanks to the listeners as well, and the other callers, and the people in the chat. Don't forget to check out Tan Stoffel's site, ageoftreason.com. Don't forget what it's all about, the 14 words. We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. We must being the key word. It's not we will secure our existence only if it's easy and nobody gets hurt. No, the word must implies that it is survival at any cost, any price, by any means required. No excuses, no whining, no begging or pleading. Whatever the hell it takes, we must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. And memes alone will not do it, nor will signs get the job done. Votes won't save our race. Prayers won't help. This is a racial holy war, a war for our very survival. What could be more important, more sacred, or more holy? Some people think holy can only be in connection with a particular religion. Look it up. It can also be something sacred, something important. And like I say, what could be more important or sacred or holy than fighting for the survival of our race? It's a cold war now, mainly, and where it is warm and hot, it's most always one-sided, with the white side taking blow after blow after blow, without striking back. And don't forget that might is right, and survival of the fittest is the law of this world. The overall stronger force will always overpower the overall weaker force. Sometimes for humans and other animals, the creation of that stronger force might require organization or, you know, just numbers, brains, brawn, technology, the deployment of effective deceit, or some combination of the aforementioned items. Now, we think that we're right and our cause is just, and we should. That's how we see it from our perspective, and we should. However, our enemies think that they're just and they're right, and nature plays no favorites, doesn't care who wins. We have to care, and beyond that, we have to make it happen. And if we care enough, we will. No matter how right we think we are, and even though we have the truth on our side, we will be defeated if we do not possess the superior might and wield it effectively, but our enemies do. The truth plays less of a role than does might. Without the might to back up our correctness, being correct or right does not really do much for us. So just being correct is not going to get us very far if we don't have the might to back it up. There is a clear white genocide agenda in place, and thus far it's been rather successful. Obviously, those that are behind that agenda and those that are implementing it and furthering it are enemies. The truth will not defeat these enemies, thus defeating the white genocide agenda. Might, force, is going to have to defeat them, Only force and might can and will defeat them and must defeat them once and for all, completely, totally. And I'm not talking about superior might or force in terms of a competition between white racial warriors and the anti-white system that revolves around numbers, you know, like the number of people on each side or anything to do with tanks or aircraft or ships or the like. No. When I think about white revolution, I think about capable, determined, ruthless, covert, destructive power as well as constructive power. One does sometimes lead to the other. So keep in mind that all's fair in love and war, and all life is about love and war. Might is right. No separation, no peace. Rahoa, take care.
Preserve the condition of power.